Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Opening statements in the sexual assault retrial of Bill Cosby are scheduled to get underway Monday, as long as 12 jurors and 6 alternates can be selected before them. Let's get the latest count with WHYY's Bobby Allen joining us from the Montgomery County Courthouse in Norristown. Bobby, where are we in the process?
So today, both sides decided on 12 jurors. That's 7 men and 5 women. Most of them appear to be middle age, but there is some age diversity. There's a number of them who look like they're in their 20s and 30s. There's one African-American male and one African-American female. The rest are white. Tomorrow, they're going to start the process of trying to find 6 alternates. And hopefully, like you said, opening statements will launch on Monday.
Though there were some tense hours today toward that end.
That's right. There was one African-American juror who the prosecution moved to strike, and the defense responded by saying this represented a systemic racial bias. They used the word it represented a racial animus. It turned into an hours-long legal slugfest between the two sides. And ultimately, the judge was willing to hold a hearing on the matter so that the defense would have an opportunity to illustrate how this is an alleged pattern of racial animus. They decided not to do that and instead said, we're going to preserve our objection and just move on. Now, that said, the prosecution claimed that, you know, it was, quote, ludicrous to call them, say that they were motivated by a racial bias. And as evidence, they said, we said yes to the first 2 African-Americans who were in front of us. So that was a bit of drama for sure.
Hard to read the tea leaves, but if they were able to select the 12 primary jurors today, is it likely that 6 alternates can be found to keep the trial on schedule?
You know, Dave, there's really no way of knowing. The defense team, and it is a large defense team, they seem to be turning a lot of things into major battles. So I don't know. It just depends on, you know, what the panel looks like and how quickly the defense will agree to another 6. There's really no way of knowing for sure. It could take more than tomorrow. We just don't know.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen on Newsworks Tonight. White girl, I got that. White girl, white girl, white girl,
white girl, white girl. New here at 9, a social worker for the state of Illinois criminally charged with sexually assaulting people with disabilities at a state-run mental health clinic.
WGN's Megan Dwyer is live in the newsroom tonight with the latest on this story. Megan?
Yeah, guys, there are now 3 lawsuits, 1 criminal and 2 civil, claiming that a former employee at the Elgin Mental Health Center took advantage of her position by making her patients her sex slaves.
53-year-old Christy Lenhart now faces 14 counts of sexual misconduct in Kane County. The charges come after a state investigation into the Elgin Mental Health Center.
I just kept it to myself for a really long time.
The criminal complaint alleges that one patient, Bendahum Hurt of Aurora, was forced to have romantic trysts with his social worker in her office and in his bedroom in the state-run facility for nearly 3 years.
I would visit my son and I would see things and I would hear things and people would slip papers to me and tell me things and I just don't like what happened.
The criminal charges follow civil suits filed in 2017 and 2018. In one of those cases, another patient, Mark Owens Jr., claimed Lenhart made sexual advances toward him when he first showed up at the facility in 2012.
He even mentioned to me that he'd rather be in jail, you know, than to be there.
When he said he wanted to stop seeing her in her private office, she allegedly retaliated against him by telling his treatment team he was paranoid and in need of stronger medication.
She can get me drugged to the gills. In all likelihood, I better do what she says.
Lenhart, a longtime state employee, resigned in August of 2017. If convicted of the criminal charges, she could face 5 years in prison. The civil lawsuits are each seeking $10,000 in damages.
It shouldn't be like this. This is a terrible crime, not just against my client, but against human dignity itself.
Bail earlier today. Her attorney told the Chicago Tribune she does not have a criminal history and they will wait for the legal process to play out. In the newsroom tonight, Megan Dwyer, back to you guys.
Okay. Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation in Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Moving on to a story from a darker chapter in California state history, the effects of which are still being felt today. Less than 100 years ago, forced sterilizations were common in state-run institutions. Now, the reasons weren't always clear. Patients were often diagnosed as morally deviant or feeble-minded. But new research shows that another aspect may have been factored in, race, and that one group in particular was disproportionately selected for the procedure, Mexican Americans. Take Two's Austin Cross is here to tell us that story. Hi, Austin.
Hi.
All right, so set the scene for us. How did it all come to be?
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, California passed a law that allowed state mental institutions and prisons to sterilize criminals and people convicted of sex crimes. But by the mid-1910s, the law was expanded, allowing the state to sterilize more or less anyone who was committed to an institution. And the end goal, in many instances, came down to money.
Money. All right, so how money?
Well, many of the people committed were poor or working class. State officials believed that if they had kids, it would burden the state. So they thought it was their job to stop the cycle of poverty early.
Wow. That's pretty jarring to hear, Austin. All right. So there's this new data that shows that most of these people were Mexican Americans. So how did that come to light?
Well, this story starts about 11 years ago. A historian at the University of Michigan came across about 20,000 sterilization requests from institutions in California made between the years of the 1920s and the 1950s. And those soon made it to the hands of two researchers.
My name is Natalie Lira. I am an assistant professor in Latino studies at the University of Illinois.
And my name is Nicole Novak. I'm a postdoctoral research scholar at the University of Iowa.
They spent a long time looking over the requests. Eventually, Nicole Novak noticed something that wasn't quite right.
Their descriptions were often really derogatory.
Derogatory? In what way?
Well, some patients were described as being, quote, of low-grade Mexican mentality. Oof. Others were just labeled menaces to their community.
Dang, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, and wow. That's what led Nicole Novak to ask an important question.
So we wanted to see whether they decided to sterilize Mexican origin or Latino patients more often.
And as it turns out, they did. To get an accurate measure, both researchers used the best indicator they could for determining a patient's race, their last name. Data from 1950 shows that about 88% of Californians with Spanish surnames were of Mexican descent, and they discovered that
even after we accounted for differences in the patient's ages or the time period when they lived, we still found that Latino men in state institutions were 23% more likely to be sterilized than non-Latino men, And the difference was even greater for Latina women, who were 59% more likely to be sterilized than non-Latina women.
So it sounds pretty clear, Austin, that race was the major factor in this decision to sterilize.
Well, Nicole Novak thought so. And after she crunched all these numbers, I asked, was she surprised?
Well, to be honest, we were not surprised by our findings because this work emerged out of really in-depth historical research about this time period. And from the ways that people talked about patients from Mexico and patients who are descended from Mexican immigrants, we were not surprised that this was the way that they treated them when they were institutionalized.
Did they know they'd been sterilized?
Natalie?
Well, it's hard to say. It was understood that a lot of them were incompetent or incapable of understanding. We probably can say that a number of them didn't know.
Wow. It's shocking, but then I guess, you know, with our history here in this country, it kind of isn't in a way, too. But the thing is, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that behind each of those numbers, that's someone's life.
You're right, A. And for every medical record on Earth, there's a person and a story. So let me put a human face on that for you.
My name is Stacy Cordova Diaz. I am the great niece of Mary Franco, who was sterilized at Pacific Colony in Pomona, California.
Medical records show that Stacy's Aunt Mary was committed on March 14, 1934. Less than 2 months later, Mary was recommended for sterilization. She was just 14.
14. So why was she sent to a state institution?
It's a story that the family didn't actually talk about for a long time, A. Then in the 1990s, Stacy took a Chicano studies class in college and had to interview a Mexican-American. So she spoke to her aunt.
Basically, she shared that she was a wild young girl and that her family didn't know what to do with her because she was very promiscuous and that she was then sterilized. And it really affected her entire life. She was very resentful to what had happened.
All right. Promiscuous as a description of someone when they're just 14 years old. That sounds strange. It also actually sounds kind of odd that a 14-year-old is committed to a state institution. I mean, there's so many problems, Austin, with all this.
Yeah, it really is strange, A. And the exact reasons that landed her there, they're a bit murky. But what is clear is that when her family caught wind of what she was doing, they did take her to that hospital, a state-run home for the so-called mentally deficient. It's there that doctors performed a salpingectomy, meaning her fallopian tubes were removed.
So did they give a reason for that?
She was diagnosed with feeble-mindedness tied to social deviance.
The story is so crazy. And the sad part is that there's so much guilt on my family's side. Like, for a long time, my family didn't want to talk about it. My mom especially was very upset and did not want to talk about it with me. Basically, it was my mom's father, her older brother, who took her with the mom. Because they were just so afraid she was going to get pregnant. And they did this procedure on her.
Okay, so what happened to Aunt Mary?
Well, Stacy Cordova Diaz says the sterilization caused her a lot of pain later in life.
She had gotten married, and when the man she married found out she couldn't have children, he left her. And so she always felt that no one ever wanted to be with her because she couldn't have children. And she always really wanted children.
Stacy says her Aunt Mary never went to baby showers. Worse still, doctors botched her surgery. A doctor who worked on her later said that she was, quote, butchered. And she faced complications until she died in 1998.
All right, Austin. So what did you take away from the story?
Well, I think that the researcher, Natalie Lira, really summed it up the best. She says that looking at the disproportionate number of sterilizations performed on Mexican Americans not only forces us to confront the racism of the past, but it also leads us to reflect on how prejudices remain not just in our individual beliefs, but in social and economic structures that have been in place for a long time. I also learned that for many people, this is a history that hits close to home. For Stacy Cordova Diaz and her family, learning more about her Aunt Mary and the thousands of others sterilized in California's state facilities is about healing.
To kind of put my mom at ease, you know, and be like, Mom, this, you don't have to be so ashamed, you know, and so sad for your family. I'm like, this just was, no one knew. They didn't know how to handle this type of, you know, young lady who could possibly bring another mouth to feed. It was scary for them.
And it's worth mentioning, A, sterilizations fell out of favor in the 1950s.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But California's sterilization law stayed on the books until 1979.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I guess we got a lot of recent reflecting to do on all this. That's Take Two's Austin Cross. Austin, thank you very much.
Thanks, A.
Can you see the pride in the panther as he glows in splendor and grace? Toppling obstacles placed in the way of the progression of his race. Can you see the pride in the panther as she nurtures her young all alone? The seed must grow regardless of the fact that it's planted and sown. Can't you see the pride in the panthers?
The Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party is celebrating its 50th anniversary this month. Some might remember it for its militancy in pursuit of racial and social justice. But the Panthers also live on in programs still happening in Seattle. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports.
By the fall of 1969, the FBI, the ATF, and other law enforcement agencies were regularly raiding Black Panther offices across the country. Seattle Panthers were ordered by the party to move from their storefront headquarters to a location that could be fortified in case of attack.
So here we are at the site of the second Black Panther Party headquarters.
Seattle Panther co-founder Elmer Dixon says the duplex they rented on 20th in the Central District doubled as their first free medical clinic. All of the walls were sandbagged.
When you walked into the front door of where the office and the clinic was, you walked through an enclosed sandbag area that had a bunker on top. And so the women that came into the first clinic, which was a well baby clinic, said they felt very safe and protected when they walked into the Panther office.
Sand was everywhere.
Former Panther Vanetta Molson lived at the bunker.
Sand was everywhere. So you just did the best you could, keep it down.
The house was communal. Molson says work and studies were shared. She sold newspapers and found donations for a free breakfast program that the Panther started nearby. But the threat of violence was often present.
Were you ever afraid?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whenever there was talk of conflict. And, you know, at any time they could come and bust in or try.
Molson says whenever there was a potential for trouble, word would go out on the phone tree. Panther allies would show up and surround the duplex to interfere with law enforcement.
And it could get very serious. You know, there was tension there.
Today, the sandbags are gone. A mural commemorating the Panther movement is the only piece of the bunker that remains. The structure was razed after the Panthers left in 1972 for new offices a block away. After the move, the Panthers focused more and more on programs to fill unmet needs in the community. In the medical clinic, volunteer doctors screened kids for a disease that at the time few were aware of, sickle cell anemia. The genetic disease is more common in persons of African descent. Elmer Dixon says the Panthers knew that.
And the efforts of the Black Panther Party gave rise to the awareness of sickle cell on a broad level across the country.
The Panthers also held legal classes and ran food programs like free breakfast for kids. Madrona Grace Presbyterian Church, nearby the Panther office and clinic, was the site of the first free breakfast program. When Dixon drops by, there's great excitement around showing off the old breakfast program sign.
Isn't that
yeah. I probably made that sign.
Within a few years, hundreds of children were getting free breakfasts from the Panthers at five locations around Seattle.
They always got scrambled eggs, they got pancakes, they got grits, they got donuts as a snack to take with them out the door. And all of this food was donated.
Dixon says the Panthers relied on strong community support to get donations they needed to run their food and medical programs. When Safeway balked, the Panthers made an offer they couldn't refuse. And when they did, the Panthers and their supporters shut the stores down.
One was on 23rd, right off of Union. The other one was on 23rd and Jackson. And the kids from the Summer Liberation School actually picketed them. And people wouldn't cross the kids' picket line. And both Safeways went out of business.
By the late 70s, Panther membership dwindled. Seattle was one of the last chapters to disband around 1980. But the legacy of the Seattle Panthers endures. The medical clinic they started is still operating today in the Central District as the Carolyn Downs Family Medical Center. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
It isn't the issue of gun control. What we need is white supremacy control.
17-year-old Dorian Harris isn't spending this Easter Sunday with his family. Instead, they're grieving his death after investigators say he was shot and killed by 28-year-old Anwar Ghazali Thursday, a clerk at this convenience store on the corner of Springdale and Howell. The arrest affidavit shows Ghazali chased Harris out of the store after he stole a beer, shooting him from behind as he walked away.
I feel like, you know, it could have been better than that. He didn't have to kill him, you know.
Harris's body wasn't found until 2 days later, next to Sarah Patton's house, just a few yards away.
I had just put my lock on my door and I heard some couple shooting. After I heard the couple shooting, I didn't, you know, come through the door. I looked out the window. I didn't see nobody running or nothing. So I didn't think no more about it.
According to court documents, a witness told police Ghazali walked back into the store after the shooting, saying, quote, "I think I shot him," but never called police.
We got no reason to be shooting no kids.
Patton tells us she had no idea Harris's body laid next to her home until investigators told her.
I didn't see it. If I had knew that it was back there, I would have called the folk before now.
Harris's loved ones hugged and cried near the crime scene Saturday, likely asking the same question as many others in the neighborhood. Why?
Actually, everybody was confused by what happened. So.
Police say the shooting was caught on camera. The owner of the store declined an interview. In Hyde Park, Nina Harrelson, WREG, News Channel 3.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true?
Is that true?
Police in New York City fatally shot a black man after mistaking a metal pipe for a gun. Callers to 911 said the man was waving a gun at people on the street, but neighborhood residents say it was well known Saeed Vassal suffered from mental illness. And as NPR's Joel Rose reports, they're questioning why police were so quick to shoot.
Saeed Vassal died where he spent most of his life, on Utica Avenue in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, between the apartment where he lived with his family and the barber shop where he liked to hang out.
Man, that's our boy. We know this man for like ever since. You know, he comes to hang out in the barber shop, you know what I mean?
David Bailey says Vassal's struggles with mental illness were no secret.
It's visible. You could see it. Listen, Ray Charles could see that man was crazy.
But also, he says, harmless. And local police knew that too, according to neighbors Angie Lewis and Kirk McLeod.
When they first said it, I couldn't believe it was him. He's not a troublemaker.
This young man wouldn't hurt a fly.
Police painted a different picture after the shooting.
This is a snapshot of one of the locations where we see the male.
On Wednesday afternoon, the NYPD says three different 911 callers reported a man pointing a silver object at several people on the street as if it were a gun. It turned out to be a piece of metal pipe with a shower head. But it's not easy to see that in the still photos or the surveillance videos that police have released. When officers showed up at the scene, police say Vassal pointed the object at them. Here's NYPD Chief of Department Terrence Monahan.
The suspect then took a two-handed shooting stance and pointed an object at the approaching officers, two of whom were in uniform.
Monahan says four officers shot Vassal. The medical examiner says he was struck a total of 9 times. Monahan says three of those officers were part of a special unit that's trained to respond to terrorism and other emergencies. And Monahan says these officers had no way of knowing about Vassal's mental health problems.
This was not an emotionally disturbed call. This was a call of a man pointing what 911 calls and people felt was a gun at people on the street. When we encounter him, he turns with what appears to be a gun at the officers.
The NYPD says it's conducting a full investigation. So is the state's attorney general. The shooting happened on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and it comes just a few weeks after a black man in Sacramento was shot and killed by police who thought he had a gun. That man was holding a cell phone. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio called the shooting in Brooklyn a tragedy on more than one level.
This is someone who had a profound mental health problem, was not on medication, hadn't been on medication. A man like this, if he had gotten the help he needed, hopefully would never have been in a situation where such a horrible, painful tragedy would have occurred.
But Saeed Vassell's neighbors in Brooklyn seem more concerned about why the NYPD was so quick to pull the trigger. Angie Lewis has lived in the neighborhood for 3 decades.
That don't look like no gun. When you see a gun, you know what a damn gun is. You work with it, don't get trigger happy.
What are you thinking right now about the NYPD?
I don't know. They need to get it together. Stop acting, responding before you find out more.
Saeed Vassell leaves behind a teenage son. He was 34 years old. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Things have happened. It's amazing when I talk to people and they say, man, I've been seeing folks protest and nothing has happened. When in reality, there are 40 new laws in 24 states. You would not have the number of police departments' body cameras. You now have city councils that are now looking at the police union contracts and rewording them. And so what do you say to the folks who are in the movement to keep them encouraged when other folks are saying nothing is happening, it's not improving, but also from your perspective, the what's next?
We have an update now on a story of a black man in Asheville beaten by a white police officer after he was stopped for jaywalking. The incident last summer was captured on body cam. The Asheville Citizen-Times got hold of the video and posted it to its website in February. It went viral and thrust the city of Asheville into a national discussion about police and their treatment of African Americans. Joel Burgess is a city reporter with the Asheville Citizen-Times who's been covering the story. We spoke with him earlier, and I asked him to remind us what happened back in August last year when now former police officer Chris Hickman stopped Johnny Germain Rush for jaywalking.
The thing I've got to tell us, too, that makes the story so strange to many of us is, although this incident happened at the end of August, we didn't learn about it really. Or at least the public didn't learn about it until February 28th when we published the video. But to rewind back to the incident you're talking about, there's a man named Johnny Germain Rush, as you said. He's a resident of a nearby housing complex, and he had gotten off work, he tells us, from a 13-hour shift at the Cracker Barrel and was walking back to a store to buy some things he had forgotten, and was stopped coming out of the store by a police officer who turns out to have been a trainee at the time, a guy named Muggiero, who confronted him and told him that he had jaywalked and you know warned him against it and checked his ID and checked his checked him for outstanding warrants or anything like that and sent him on his way. The encounter, that first encounter, was a little bit confrontational. I think that Rush was annoyed at being stopped. But then he was stopped again, really at the foot of his apartment complex as he was trying to go home. And the officers said that, and again, this was Ruggiero, a trainee, and the officer who was training him is a man named Chris Hickman, who's no longer with the Asheville Police Department, but had been there for 10 years and was actually a decorated veteran. And stopped this man, Rush, who, as you pointed out, was African-American, and told him that he had jaywalked again and that he was either going to get a ticket or go to jail. And Rush protested and said he actually, at that point, hadn't done anything wrong and really was trying to comply with what they had asked him to do. And, you know, people who watch the tape know this, but he was frustrated, visibly frustrated, audibly frustrated. The officers became angry with him. The system, the situation escalated, and the officers moved to arrest him. And Rush began to run, and then stopped, is what he said. This officer Hickman tackled him, and then the encounter turned really violent at that point. It was Rush was shocked multiple times with a taser. He was beaten. Hickman beat him with his fist, his closed fist, and with the taser, with the stun gun, and choked him. It appears 2 times, once with his hands and once in what officers refer to as a chokehold, what we commonly refer to as a chokehold, but which the Asheville Police Department now considers lethal force. So, again, this incident happened back in late August, and really nobody knew about it, and we didn't know about it until we caught wind of it, and through a source, and I started talking to this source and eventually was able to get a body cam video of Officer Chris Hickman that showed us that, yes, in fact, this incident had happened as described.
And you got the body cam video, and it was posted at the Asheville Citizen Times website so then everybody could see it. But you said, as you said, this was February. But there were things happening in the meantime, albeit some of it out of the public view. So let's talk about what happened right afterward, because Officer Hickman was told to turn in his badge and gun. Let's tell me when that happened and why.
Well, the police chief, Tammy Hooper, who's been there since 2015, said that she got a complaint the very next day. And she said it was Rush who made a verbal complaint about the incident. And so she began what's called an internal investigation, or it's a non-criminal administrative investigation where basically the chief would be looking at whether she should discipline or fire an officer. So she immediately took him off the street. He wasn't fired at that time. He was essentially doing desk duty. And this investigation stretched on several months, actually. And it midway through, though, so in September, officers that were doing that investigation approached the district attorney with the video, either some or all of the video. We're still not sure how much the DA saw. He believes he only saw a piece of it. That's his recollection. The district attorney's name is Todd Williams, by the way. And these officers were saying, hey, we want to drop the charges that the officers brought against Mr. Rush, which were, you know, resisting a public officer, trespassing, impeding traffic, a variety of things like that. And the district attorney agreed. So again, this is September, you know, a month after the incident, a little less. And the administrative investigation continued. And in December, the police chief, Tammy Hooper, and essentially these officers who were doing an investigation came back to the DA and said, we've got more information and we'd like your opinion. We think maybe, you know, this should be a criminal case. So the unusual thing about this, and this gets into some of the weird nuts and bolts of these situations, is it seems like very commonly in this type of scenario, a criminal investigation and an administrative investigation would start at the same time. And it seems like a strange thing to focus on. But the point is, you got to keep those two investigations separate, because a criminal investigation involves things like Miranda rights, where essentially you're told, you know, you're allowed to be quiet, you don't have to say anything that might incriminate yourself, whereas the administrative investigation, somebody can remain quiet, but you'll be telling them, look, if you refuse to tell us things, we'll fire you. And so it's kind of good if these two things happen at the same time on different tracks, and they don't touch each other. So it was very strange that this criminal investigation took this long to happen. And again, it didn't even start in December. That was when this information was submitted to the district attorney. And then come January, the district attorney said he really got around to reviewing all the information over the holidays and whatnot, and said, yes, oh my goodness, let's contact the State Bureau of Investigation. But the SBI declined at that time.
And why was that?
Well, the reason they gave, at first they gave no reason, is what the DA and what the police chief said. And so actually the chief started her own investigation, which is, again, problematic, because you have police officers investigating fellow officers, you know, and officers within their own departments. And it's
and at this point, let me just add, sorry to interrupt you, but at this point, the video is still not public. And remember, the state legislature has kept that from public view. They've said that the police don't have to turn that over. So still, the public doesn't know what's happened yet.
That's exactly right. And even some elected officials and a top city official said he didn't know about it. But yes, so the SBI has, according to the police chief and the district attorney, has declined to tell them why. But we pushed them a little bit, and finally there was a reason given. And what they said was, you know, it took too long. You guys came to us too late to ask for this. And the SBI didn't offer a lot more explanation, a lot of background. But the sense we got is they felt that maybe the waters had been a bit muddied between this administrative investigation and what would be a criminal investigation. Williams, the DA, said he really wanted the SBI to do the investigation, not the Asheville police. And so he pressed again and again. And finally, the explanation came out, and this is I have to say this is actually after a few days after the release of the video by us, the FBI said, well, we can't because we're cooperating with a federal investigation of this incident.
Meanwhile, Officer Chris Hickman had been fired, and that was prior to the video coming out.
That's correct. So January 5th, I guess the chief had felt she'd gathered enough information to fire him. And it's worth saying that it apparently is a lot harder to fire a police officer or any other municipal employee in Asheville because there is another layer of review. It's called a civil service board. It's really unique to Asheville and North Carolina from what I can tell. And it's a place where an employee can go and appeal a disciplinary action such as a firing. And so I think the chief in later explaining the reason it took so long to get to this point was that she really felt like she had to build a case because there were past incidents where officers had been fired and for excessive force, and then they were reinstated by the Civil Service Board. So, yes, on January 5th, the chief has shown us she had a letter with that date saying, you know, I'm going to terminate you. But that very same day, Officer Hickman said, I resign and quit.
All right. And there are new developments since then. Of course, at the Asheville Citizen Times got a copy of got the video, and that went public. That was in February. What's happened since then?
For one thing, we've had the confirmation that a federal investigation is happening. We had actually heard before we published the video, that some FBI agents had come and interviewed Johnny Rush. But yes, the FBI actually confirmed there was a federal investigation. A grand jury convened in Asheville, a federal grand jury convened in Asheville April 3rd, so just this week. And we got a hold of the subpoenas that were sent out by the federal attorneys, the federal prosecutors, to look for information to give to this grand jury to see if they actually will indict anyone. And so the FBI and the Justice Department in general, these federal investigations, the reason they happen in these cases are to look into civil rights violations.
What about activism in Asheville? What about in the African-American community and others interested in this case? Is there any kind of groundswell of pressure on City Hall and the police chief over this case?
Well, yes. And in fact, I did skip over some very important things, which is after the video became public, there was absolute outrage. There was outrage among a lot of black residents. There was outrage among white residents. But for black residents, it was particularly poignant. It was one of these incidents that, again, captured on video. It just seemed to reinforce this sense that they were being treated pretty poorly and in some cases violently by the police. This is something actually that the city had been focusing on. There had been a fatal shooting of a black city resident in 2016, a man named Jerry Jai Williams. And that incident was eventually ruled justified by the district attorney, but it really galvanized a movement around trying to get better treatment of black residents by police, and just a sense that there was mistreatment and potential bias. And so the police chief, with the help and cooperation of community activists, created a new use of force policy. And so, ironically, this use of force policy came into effect in May, just months before the Johnny Rush incident, when there was, in fact, excessive force, according to the police, according to their own assessment of the incident. So, yes, there was this outrage. There was also outrage. There was outrage that it happened, and then there was also outrage that nobody knew about it for months. And that included members of the city council. Members of the city council said they knew nothing about it. The mayor said she knew nothing about it. The city manager said the first he had heard of this incident was when we released it, when we published it publicly. And in the aftermath, there were residents that called for the firing of the police chief and the city manager. And in fact, the city manager, Gary Jackson, was fired. The city council members said they actually wanted to retain the police chief. They characterized her as a change agent in a department that has problems. And one thing just prior to the release of this video, the police department had released figures showing a 61% decrease in use of force incidents. And, of course, here's this one glaring exception.
You know, I've always wanted to be a cop. With a uniform fit, we're calm to the seams. Peeing in niggas, call the greens, and they discuss the politics of dreams. That's why I've always wanted to be a cop.
Protesters have filled the streets of Sacramento almost nonstop since the police shooting of Stephon Clark last month. They blocked Sacramento Kings fans from games, jammed drivers during their rush hour commutes, and filled the city council chambers twice for a public forum, including last night. But there's been little violence and just two arrests. As Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports, it appears police and protesters have thus far learned to, if not work together, at least coexist.
Get back, get back.
We want freedom, freedom.
At one of the daily afternoon Black Lives Matter marches last week in downtown Sacramento, a crowd of protesters who had already claimed a rush hour intersection walked right up to police officers and chanted provocatively in their faces.
We don't need them, need them.
It was one of the many tense moments since police officers shot Stephon Clark last month that could have escalated into a riot, but it didn't. After a few minutes, the cops backed off and retreated down the alleyway. A short while later, some of the protesters broke off from the main group and marched into clogged traffic, but organizers called them back. No arrests at that day's protests and no violence. It looked like a deliberate effort from both sides to keep the peace, even as the community burned with anger. And it was. Here's Police Chief Daniel Hahn.
For the most part, we've allowed people to take streets and intersections. That hasn't come without anger in our community. But I think it was the right decision at those times because it didn't lead to more tragedy in our city.
And here's community activist Barry Axios.
There has been police that have held some restraint, and there has been great community leadership that has been able to kind of hold back certain aggressions and agitation.
Another protest Saturday night marked a contrast in law enforcement styles. It was just outside city limits under Sacramento County Sheriff's Department jurisdiction. Protesters surrounded two sheriff's vehicles, pounding and kicking the cars. Here's a video posted to social media. The first driver was able to escape the crowd. The second deputy hit a protester, then left the scene. Later, the sheriff's helicopter ordered protesters to disperse or risk arrest, and dozens of deputies lined up in riot gear. Here's how Sheriff Scott Jones justified it a couple of days later.
When the exercise of rights transitions from the mere inconvenience of others to impacting their rights, whether it's the public, the protesters themselves, or my officers, the sheriff's department must and will intervene.
Many cities in which officer-involved shootings have led to protests have avoided the riots and arrests that plagued cities like Ferguson and Baltimore. And there's a playbook for how to do that, says David Cooper, a former police chief in Madison, Wisconsin, who writes the Improving Police blog.
If a police department is close to the community, listens to the community, and treats the community with respect and dignity, the chance for there being urban chaos after a bad shooting is greatly reduced.
Cooper likens it to making deposits in the community's trust bank year after year, so that after a divisive police shooting, a city can make a withdrawal. Sacramento has implemented community-oriented policing for years, and although Daniel Hahn has only been police chief for less than a year, he's built deep relationships with neighborhood groups, as have elected officials like Mayor Daryl Steinberg.
The country's watching. And what the country has seen is not Ferguson. It's seen in many ways the opposite.
That could change if the official investigation now underway does not lead to what protesters are demanding, criminal charges against the officers who shot Stephon Clark. Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio News.
You'll find more coverage of Stephon Clark's death and subsequent protests at capradio.org/StephonClark.
For a long period of time, every conversation was wiretapped secretly by the FBI, and the contents of the conversations written down, transcribed verbatim, and put in files marked top secret. And a top agent of the FBI said that Martin Luther King Jr. is the most dangerous and most powerful Negro in America.
Right now, a report from Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. She has been looking into why conspiracy theories continue to flourish about the murder of Martin Luther King.
Walter Cronkite broke the news to his TV audience the night of April 4th, 1968.
Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene.
After an international manhunt, authorities apprehended James Earl Ray at an airport in London. Ray, a sometime bank robber, pleaded guilty to King's murder in 1969, in part to avoid the death penalty. But Ray backtracked on the story days later, and that has left some room for doubt ever since. 8 years after King's death in 1976, Congress launched its own investigation.
The House Select Committee on Assassinations held its first public hearing today on the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. Representative Walter Fauntroy delivered opening statements.
Martin Luther King Jr. used to say that truth, crushed to earth, will rise again. We are making a serious effort to establish what in fact was the truth.
The effort was serious. Disclosures that King had been hounded by the FBI and its director, J. Edgar Hoover, gave rise to lots of questions about possible government involvement in his death. The House committee hired engineers to trace the path of the bullet that hit King as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. They enlisted forensic experts to study the autopsy report, and they interviewed lots of witnesses. One was the convicted killer, James Earl Ray. G. Robert Blakey was the chief counsel to the House Select Committee.
And so we worried about, was there somebody else involved in King's death?
The House investigation found Ray had purchased the rifle likely used to shoot King, and Blakey says he found no involvement by the FBI or the Ku Klux Klan. But he still wonders whether Ray was motivated by the lure of a financial reward.
The truth of the matter is, conspiracy investigations need to be made at the time of the crime.
Blakey says the FBI could not win approval for wiretaps to snoop on Ray's brothers at the time, and so a key question lingered without a decisive answer. Meanwhile, from prison, Ray continued to maintain his innocence. He attracted allies like William Pepper, who became his lawyer. Here's Pepper in a 2013 interview about that relationship.
I spent 5 hours interrogating Ray with enormous tension and pressure. We all came away and said, this guy didn't do it.
Pepper appealed the case. He tried the Supreme Court. No luck.
It looked like we were at the end of the road. And then I came up with an idea that, well, look, why don't we try to have a real trial on television?
HBO broadcast that mock trial in 1993, and the TV jury found Ray not guilty. The media interest attracted some new voices, voices like Lloyd Jowers, who owned a bar and grill near the motel in Memphis. Here he is with Sam Donaldson on ABC in 1993.
Mr. Jowers, did James Earl Ray kill Dr. Martin Luther King?
No, he did not.
Do you know who killed Dr. King?
I know who was paid to do it.
That account from Lloyd Jowers provoked a new round of questions about King's murder. James Earl Ray, ailing and serving a 99-year prison sentence, once again pushed for a way to reopen the case, and thus began another investigation. Local prosecutors in Memphis were looking at claims by Jowers and others.
There's a lot of people that, yes, all of a sudden just came out of the woodwork.
John Campbell was an assistant district attorney at the time. Investigators went back and interviewed people who were at Jowers Bar and Grill in 1968. Campbell says many of those people failed to back him up. And Jowers himself changed his tune from what he told the FBI at the time of the murder.
Within a couple of weeks, we pretty much figured that this first story was not going to go anywhere. It wasn't true.
Something else was happening around that time, another investigation, this one by the U.S. Justice Department under President Bill Clinton. Veteran civil rights prosecutor Barry Kowalski led the effort.
We conducted a conscientious and a thorough investigation. And just like the four official investigations before it found no credible evidence or reliable evidence that Dr. King was killed by conspirators who framed James Earl Ray.
Prosecutors interviewed 200 witnesses and reviewed tens of thousands of documents. They found Jowers and the theory of a government-directed conspiracy were not credible, and they discounted other allegations, claims the murder was somehow linked to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Again, Barry Kowalski.
Now, 20 years later, I remain absolutely convinced that those well-founded findings were correct.
Still, doubters remained. Three of the men who investigated the crime told NPR the case will never be closed in some people's minds. Blakey, who drafted the federal wiretapping and racketeering laws, said there's almost too much evidence in the King case. John Campbell, the former assistant district attorney in Memphis, says he still gets questions about his investigation.
You just don't think these powerful people, these people who are larger than life, can be killed by just some, you know, nobody with a gun. You know, it has to be more. It has to be more involved. Well, sometimes there's not more involved.
Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
I believe that there was a decision made that some response on the part of the Black Panther Party has to be made to what happened to King.
Eldridge Cleaver was worried that if the Panthers didn't take decisive action, they would cease to be the vanguard. So he had this idea of actually actively attacking the police. He goes and he approaches members of the party in Oakland, and all of the older people refuse to participate. They knew that this would be suicide. But the youngest member of the party, little Bobby Hutton, decides to follow Eldridge into battle.
Next, we have a bit of hidden history from 50 years ago today. We recall what happened, of course, on April 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King was killed. Karen Grigsby Bates of our Code Switch team reports on what happened 2 days later.
April 6, 1968. While plans went forward in Atlanta for Dr. King's funeral, Oakland's Black Panther Party had plans of its own.
There was a plan on the part of several carloads of Panthers that evening after Martin Luther King was killed that they were going to do something to retaliate.
That's Kathleen Cleaver, a former Black Panther Party officer. Today, Cleaver teaches law at Emory University. In 1968, she was a Black Panther married to Eldridge Cleaver, one of the organization's most prominent and polarizing members. Several cities had gone up in flames after King's assassination. Oakland had not, in part because Black Panthers circulated in many of Oakland's Black neighborhoods urging people to be cool. Kathleen Cleaver says the relationship between these neighborhoods and Oakland's police force has a difficult history.
The Oakland police beat up a lot of people. They were considered brutal, arrogant. And one of the issues in the Oakland police is that the Oakland police were in many cases not from Oakland.
Eldridge Cleaver believed the police would soon find a reason to violently discipline the more radical elements of his community. So he engineered what he called a preemptive strike against the police. Bobby Hutton, a 17-year-old who joined the Panthers to police the police, was there.
Little Bobby Hutton represented for everyone sort of the next wave.
Ricky Vincent lectures at Berkeley and CalArts about the cultural legacy of the Black Panther Party. His mother was a Panther.
He was the youth. He was the person that folks thought was going to carry forward the vision of the party.
So on April 6, against the advice of older Panthers, some of the younger members of the party went looking to confront the police. Charles Jones, head of the Africana Studies Department at the University of Cincinnati, edited The Black Panther Party Reconsidered, a book of essays on Panther history. Jones described the confrontation this way.
Unfortunately, it was the consequences of an ill-advised military operation initiated and led by Eldridge Cleaver.
The Panthers and several carloads of police exchanged fire. At one point, Cleaver and Hutton holed up in the basement of the home of two elderly sisters. When one of the incoming bullets caught fire, Cleaver told Hutton they needed to surrender to avoid being burned alive. Charles Jones.
Eldridge, being wise, has spent many years in prison, understood the stakes at hand, and tried to persuade little Bobby Hutton to come out of the home completely nude.
That way, Jones said, it would be obvious to police that Hutton was no threat. But Hutton refused. Kathleen Cleaver explains.
He was embarrassed, and he took off his shirt, but he didn't want to take off his pants. And he came out of the basement with his hands in the air, and they shot him.
Most reports say the 17-year-old was shot at least 10 times. Eldridge Cleaver was injured but survived. Eldridge Cleaver falsely claimed the police ambushed the Panthers, a claim he did not correct for over a decade, and many in the Bay Area were outraged that the unarmed young man had been killed. We called the Oakland Police Department for comment and have not heard back. On April 12, 1968, more than 1,000 people came to Bobby Hutton's funeral. Actor and activist Marlon Brando gave the eulogy and afterward addressed an even bigger crowd at a local park. He told them white America needed to understand that racism was turning black America into a ticking time bomb.
And somehow that has to be translated to the white community now. Time's running out for everybody.
Hutton's death catapulted the Black Panthers from a local group to a national organization that eventually had several chapters throughout the United States. And though he's gone, little Bobby Hutton lives on in a day annually dedicated to his memory. Tomorrow, many from Oakland's myriad communities will observe Bobby Hutton Day again, and they'll gather in Bobby Hutton Grove, part of a public park that now bears his name. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
The whites told the people who are working, you must be very, very careful about a communist woman who has been placed in your community. Don't talk to her. And even the school children, they were told by their masters, don't talk to a certain woman called Winnie Mandela who has been placed in your community. She is a communist.
You are in for a treat. We are doing a radio narration of the life, times, and person of Winnie Madikizela Mandela this hour. You think you know Winnie? You don't. One or two of you do, because I have a diverse listenership. Many of you who love her don't know the details of why indeed you should love her. And many of you who rightly, because you're entitled to raise critical questions about her, will be empowered to do so with a level of nuance that you currently do not have. I make those bold predictions because I've got two excellent guests. The first here in the studio is Vashna Jagannath, who's an historian, and we love her. And we are very happy to have on the show, despite the occasion. Vashna, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Eusebius, for having me.
On the line, we also have Karima Brown, who also wears many hats. She's not here today as a broadcaster, although, of course, she is my broadcasting colleague here on 702, but as a very seasoned political journalist, including one that was very involved in the struggle for justice, including also the committee that was responsible for that segue out of prison into the world of freedom of Nelson Mandela, and therefore has lots of her own experiential knowledge in relation to Winnie and the lifetimes and person of Winnie. Sometimes the most incredible early political connections we get are from moms and dads, older aunts, who are not called political icons because they don't become that famous, but actually who role model to us exactly in the way in which Mawini's long line of interesting and fascinating women in her life had role modeled to her. Last night, for example, we spoke to Elizabeth, who spoke about how Mawini connected with many women across Cape Town, particularly across the Cape Flats, who are working as machinists and who are in the factories, for example. But it's interesting, isn't it, that what Vashna has said is that classic example of how important it is to re-remember that brilliant women in history do not necessarily sup politics for the first time when they go on a date with men.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the dichotomy around explaining Winnie Mandela, of course, is that she was married to a man whom the world has turned into, you know, a reified saint. And so whenever we look at her, we have to cross this big hurdle to get to her. And I think we need to stop that. I think we need to evaluate what she brought to her own life, the lives of people that she touched, and, of course, her remarkable resilience in demanding his release, his unconditional release. And for me, one of the things that really, really, you know, resonates with me is that she always understood the principles around which we needed to wage our struggle. So this constant refrain from the police that Nelson Mandela can be released tomorrow if he renounces violence, you know, just spurred her on to speak to us and to speak to young people and to the women that she met often in Cape Town when her visits were just summarily cancelled. And she insisted on meeting activists and women, particularly in the trade union movement. She would remind us of the fact that ours is first and foremost a political struggle, but yes, that we were involved in armed propaganda and that we needed to become soldiers of Mkhonto we Sizwe. And Winnie Madikizela Mandela, for me, was a woman of action, but also she believed, and she made us believe, Eusebius, that we can defeat the most powerful Boer army on the African continent. Freedom in our lifetime was the message that she conveyed to young women like myself and many women like Elizabeth and others that they organized in factories. And that had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that she was married to Nelson Mandela. That came from her own life, her own interactions, and most importantly, her own struggles against apartheid colonialism. And I think when we remember Winnie Madikizela Mandela, it's important to give her the space and the honor as a revolutionary in her own right.
You know, Vashana, what is so fascinating also is when you are a social worker and you are at the proverbial coal face of how injustice in the state plays out experientially for people on the ground, we seldom see that as a site of political activism. We see it as a place where you are doing remedial work to try and put a plaster over the wounds of those who are physically and mentally wounded by the inherent violence of the apartheid system. But what you have described is both Mawini as a social worker doing that, which is important work on its own, if that's all she did for the rest of her life. But from there, you also have a grand political identity that emerges. Where does the story go to from there? At what point does she then intersect with ANC history as we've come to know it?
Well, she begins to intersect with ANC history as soon as she comes to Johannesburg. And it's with the Sisulu and the Tambo families and so on. And she joins the Women's League and she becomes interested in politics very quickly. However, she's very young. She's only 22 at this point and she's already got her social work degree. She's already been offered these scholarships to travel. And then she meets Nelson Mandela. He sees her at a bus stop one day and he talks about being struck by her absolute beauty, which also is another key feature of her, is her beauty was quite exceptional. And what I have to say about her is that she did not shy away from that, as so many women in politics are meant to. If you are about politics and if you're about serious business and if you are concerned about other people's welfare, then you shouldn't be concerned about yourself. But Ma Winnie actually was concerned about herself. She took care of herself. She looks exceptionally always well-dressed and beautiful, and at the same time, she was a revolutionary. Those two aren't, like, you don't have to choose either or, and I thought that was very useful for her, because she refused. In politics, it's fine to be a woman in politics, but you must know your role, and your role is not to be a sexual being, it's not to be a beautiful being, especially if you're a woman, and she defied that. So he falls in love with her, and very quickly, she writes about how everyone says, oh, did she get political from that? There's a fantastic interview she does in the 1980s. And she says, no, she says, I already had my politics. In fact, we never spoke about politics because we spent so little time together. So she was getting it from the Lillian Ngoyi's. She was getting it from the Women's League. She was very, very much influenced by those politics. And she has a beautiful thing here, which I hope you don't mind if I read it to you, from one of her books where she says here, and I think this is really important, where she talks about her decision to enter fighting and her decision to become absolutely militant about this. She says, I was aware of the fact that I suddenly discovered, oh, I have no name now. Everything I did as Mandela's wife, I lost my individuality. Mandela's wife said this. Mandela's wife was resisted. It did not matter who the hell I was. It did not matter that I was Madikizela. It did not matter that I was a human being, and it was understandable to the oppressor that whatever they did to Mandela's wife, she deserved it. So I thought, my goodness, I've grown up a princess in my own home. I've come from the royal house of Pondoland, and suddenly I've lost my identity because of the struggle. I am going to fix them. I will fight them and I will establish my own identity. I did that deliberately. I said I was not going to bask in his shadow and be known as Mandela's wife. They were going to know me as Zaniwe Madikizela. I fought for that. I said I will not even bask in his politics. I'm going to form my own identity because I never did bask in his ideas. I had my own mind.
And that's exactly why I've been underscoring something that I do feel very passionate about this morning, Vashna, which is the idea of filling a vacuum, which is an underhanded compliment. But as a Madikizela, as a social worker, mm-hmm. as a politically conscious young woman mm-hmm. at that, you already have political agency in full throttle.
Exactly.
And you are not merely filling the vacuum when the man has gone off, whether it be to war, mm-hmm. whether it be to the mines, mm-hmm. or whether it be incarcerated.
Exactly. And not to also mention the fact that she did the work of filling the vacuum of Nelson Mandela, because not in the sense that she was now taking his place, the fact that Mandela was absent from South Africa, but she continuously reminded us of his presence. Mandela didn't go to Robben Island alone. There were many other people that went to Robben Island with Mandela, but the name that everyone remembers, and by the 1980s comes to know much more than anyone else, Sisulu or Tambo or anyone, is Nelson Mandela. And that is the work that Winnie did in keeping his name alive, in making sure he wasn't forgotten. So not only was she carving her own political path and becoming a revolutionary in her own right, she ensured that whatever revolutionary credentials Mandela had when he went into jail was remembered and continued to grow.
Karima, I want to invite you to reflect on the second theme around Ma Winnie that I wanted us to lift to the surface, which is the peculiar sacrifices and challenges that come with not being able to give full attention to certain roles that you may love or that are imposed on you by society, such as parenting or parenting alone. And this is something that obviously you are profoundly aware of as well. So many South Africans in small ways and in big ways had this horrible choice, not choice really, but conditions of history imposed on you, where sometimes it's a question between leaving in the early hours of the morning and paying full attention to taking your kids to the school, explaining to your children why they can't see dad or can't see dad as often. And when she is rendered mother of the nation, we forget that she was also mother to children. Give us some texture in terms of the challenges of mothering in the context of the lifetimes and person of Winnie.
You know, you see this, it's probably one of the most underwritten and under-explained parts of what constitutes our society. For me, often when I think about the apartheid system in its totality, and when I look at what we experience as a society, I constantly get so angry at the destruction of black family life. And of course, Winnie Madikizela Mandela is one among millions of South Africans whose lives were irrevocably changed as a result of a system that was described as a crime against humanity. But I think, you know, there are instances in history where Winnie Madikizela Mandela is forcibly removed from her home when the police come and harass her. And of course, she's terrified that her two young daughters are left alone. And I have seen various images and films where, you know, she fights physically with police to be able to hold on to her children, to be able to know that they're going to be okay. And on the occasions, and this is the other thing that people don't realize, Winnie Madikizela Mandela was in prison. She was banished and her children were taken from her. And I think that it is something that for me became clear at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You know, it was, I was at the session where Archbishop Tutu begged Ma Winnie to speak to what happened with Stompie. But preceding that, you had Zinzi giving testimony of what was happening at their lives. Their childhood was taken from them. Their mother was taken from them. They were adults from the time they were very little. And of course, that is not unique, but it was exemplified. And elevated in the case of Mandela. And the story there, if you go back to the transcripts, if you listen to Zinzi's growing up, her interface with the men in her mother's life, in her home, then you can see the loss of innocence, the loss of a childhood. And there is no, there is nothing that can fix that, Eusebius. There is no amount of penance that can explain the destruction of black family life. And if apartheid is ever to be held accountable for one thing, it is that. It is the breaking of families and the tortured lives and the generational pain that carries from one generation to the next. If you read someone like Zuleika Mandela's book about her struggle with cancer, her struggle with sexual abuse, then you can see how the innocence was just gone. And to parent in conditions like that, where you are expected to lead the entire country, but you can't ensure the safety of your little girl when you are forcibly taken from your home. Those are things that many of us have lived with for many years. And we haven't even begun as a society to talk about how we fix that. And
compounded, Karima, compounded by two simultaneous things, I would imagine. The natural instinct of a parent plus the professional knowledge of a social worker of what these conditions do to children.
Absolutely. And of course, you sit with that guilt. You sit with that sense of failure. You sit with that sense of you couldn't protect your own child. I mean, any parent will know exactly what that feels like. It's a powerlessness that renders you paralyzed. And for someone like Winnie Madikizela Mandela and other women to be in that situation, you know Rehana Rousseau, the author. I remember when Rihanna was detained under Section 29, she had just had Jihad, her young son, and she demanded that she wanted him with her in jail. And we had a big discussion about whether it's the right thing for him to be there, but she wanted her child with her because she felt that she was able to then at least be there and if anything happened. So those were the choices that women were often confronted with. And someone like Winnie Madikizela Mandela, of course, had to constantly live that.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, people forget what it was like to go to Robben Island. The big boats that you use now, those weren't the boats. The most horrific little dinghies were there. People got violently ill, and these children would be on the boats. And then you would come there, and the visit would be summarily cancelled, you know. And you would have to explain to your child why you were not able to see your parent, and to be able to not do anything about it. That sense of powerlessness is personally there. But I think it also accounts for why she was so determined to fight Eusebius and why she was so relentless about resistance.
Winnie Madikizela Mandela, 1936-2018. She was born in 1936 and named Namzamo Winifred Madikizela, but the world would come to know this South African beauty as Winnie Mandela, the wife of African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. Their lives, their struggles for freedom, dignity, and liberation from the racist ignominy known as apartheid, filled most of the 20th century. He, Nelson, labored under the eye of the harsh apartheid sun, breaking rocks in the prison yard, while she, Winnie, labored under the white state's total surveillance while she raised their children. While not widely known, her suffering included not only separation from her husband, but the cruel legality called banning, a South African censorship that outlawed her speech, not allowing her to quote her husband's words. Winnie, a lifelong rebel, ignored such law and proudly quoted Nelson, and she suffered her own imprisonment as well. She was banished to Bloemfontein, a white Afrikaner district, where the only blacks she saw were servants or cooks for white families. She continued to resist the racist government. The ANC was banned, and she wore the ANC colors as a headdress. And when, after Nelson's freedom, the marriage ended, She remained a powerful presence in South African life, loved by the nation's poor and dispossessed. For they knew, in their heart of hearts, that their struggle was her struggle. In her 1984 book, Part of My Soul Went With Him, Winnie Mandela wrote, "I have ceased a long time ago to exist as an individual. The ideals, the political goals that I stand for, those are the ideals and goals of the people in this country. They cannot just forget their own ideals. My private self doesn't exist. Whatever they do to me, they do to the people of this country." Several years ago, when Nelson was being laid to rest, his third wife, Graça Michelle Mandela, stumped in grief, was given a hug and a kiss to console her by his second wife, Winnie. Namzamo Winnie Mandela Madikizela, a class act to the very end, and a lifelong revolutionary. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 7th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, analysis on any of the audio segments that we just heard. If you have any counter-racist suggestions, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Couple things before we get to the callers. First of all, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Tremendous thanks to all of the listeners, investors who have supported the Cows 9 years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Also, thanks, gratitude to all the folks who've nabbed items from the wish list. It's at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. It's linked on my blog. Again, huge thanks to all the folks who have supported. I hope the context of white supremacy has helped non-white listeners, victims of white supremacy, get an accurate understanding of what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white. A couple other things I wanted to say briefly before we get to the callers. I think retired firefighter, he mentioned the documentary on Dr. King, and there were quite a few. I mean, whites, they really did it up this past, the past 7 days with the Dr. King material. But he mentioned the HBO documentary, King in the Wilderness. It's about 2 hours long. He said he thought it was constructive. I posted the link on the Cows Group page on Facebook. So if you want to check it out, download it, feel free. I've seen most of it. I think I've missed like the last 30 minutes of it, but I was able to see most of it. It's It's a documentary, and it has lots of archival footage, a lot of footage I had not seen before, even though it is mostly focused on the last year of his life. So I think it's always good to learn about things, to get more details, to know more details about history and things that have happened. That said, there were key critiques that I had of the documentary, if anybody checks it out. The first one, they did kind of a brief, and I mean a super brief summary of some of the earlier events in Dr. King's life. And one of those events was the March Against Freedom. James Meredith, who I have the highest regard for, James Meredith, veteran as well, but he was doing his march against fear in Mississippi. He was shot. And so Dr. King and Kwame Ture, at the time Stokely Carmichael, many others, they come to Mississippi to pick up the march where Mr. Meredith was shot. James Meredith, the black student who is credited with what they call integrating Ole Miss, the University of Mississippi as well. Anyway, this is where Stokely Carmichael is publicly saying black power, and that causes a big to-do. And in the film, in the documentary, my view is that they made it seem like Stokely Carmichael was just this rowdy, angry Negro. And Dr. King didn't take it personal. He knew it's just rowdy, angry Negro. You know, he doesn't know any better. He's just out here yelling, foaming at the mouth. We're going to go ahead and do the nonviolent way and redeem the soul of America. I felt like that was said so many times in the film. I have no idea what that means. This is the compensatory call-in. No metaphors. One of my other critiques of the film, I felt like they made a point of emphasizing Dr. King as a sexual pervert. This is something we talked about when we read Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, last summer, in fact. But she denied emphatically that he had an affair, that he confessed to an affair. We talked about this in context of Ava DuVernay's film, Selma, as well. But she denied that fervently in her autobiography, said no such thing, and even suspected racist John Patash, when he was on the program, he's written about COINTELPRO extensively, said, man, perhaps we should be suspicious about all of these lies and innuendo rumors that he was this, you know, sexual freak and just having all these affairs and running around with. Maybe we should back up the source of this since it's COINTELPRO. Maybe this could all just be a bunch of racist deception. Maybe he wasn't engaged in all this misbehavior. Anyway, they made a big point of that in the film. I didn't agree. Next, the last one was William Sullivan. They reference William Sullivan as an FBI agent, very high individual classified as white at the FBI. I think he was ranked as the number third individual behind J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI during the 1960s. He was there at the time when Dr. King was assassinated. He was there at the time when President Kennedy was assassinated. Lots of these major COINTELPRO type activities. He was there and in a very high position. He was supposed to testify at that House Select Committee on Assassinations. This is what Gus T. was doing before I got into counter-racism, was studying just this specific chunk of what was going on in the 60s with COINTELPRO. Lots and lots of time, even while I was... Anyway, so William Sullivan, he ended up... He was going to testify. He got upset with J. Edgar Hoover. He was going to testify about what he did, what he saw, being at the FBI in such a lofty position. He was going to testify at those hearings, but he ended up dying in a hunting accident days before he was scheduled to testify. I thought it was really tacky, and in my view, an act of racism that was left out of the King documentary, unless it came up somehow towards the end that I haven't seen. And I thought it was especially tacky with the NPR segment that we heard during the audio clip, that there was no mention of COINTELPRO in the NPR segment and the pervasiveness of that program, including where they have admitted to being involved in murders of black people. What happened with Fred Hampton in Chicago, 1969. Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, he wasn't the only one, but not acknowledging their involvement in these types of activities And if they're involved in killing individuals like Fred Hampton, who was nowhere near the stature of Dr. King, why would we think that they would be above participating in getting rid of him with all, everything else that they were orchestrating against him over the decade? I just thought they did a really poor job. And I almost included Thomas in New York's audio segment from the last couple of days where he said, didn't they have a trial? You're darn tootin' they had a trial, a civil trial in 1999. The full transcript is on the King Center website. I'm going to post it. I'll tweet it, Facebook it, share it widely. But the transcript is there. And a jury of 12 decided, yes, there was a conspiracy involving all these people. Now, they will say, well, that's a civil trial. That's a, what they say, lower bar of proof, lower burden of proof, as opposed to a criminal trial. Fine, you can include that as well. But I thought that that was really tacky and, in my view, probably a direct, deliberate act of white supremacy to exclude that, oh, yeah, there was a civil trial where they did think, yeah, there is enough evidence that there's a conspiracy. Moving forward, the segment on Christy Linhart, that is the suspected racist white woman who's arrested and facing criminal charges for making sex slaves out of black males. They had video on that. I can post, or actually I don't have to because a lot of listeners posted it on my Facebook page this week, but they have videos where it's black males are the ones accusing her of raping. They had the audacity in that news clip to say a romantic tryst is what Christy Linhart was requiring them to participate in. Can you imagine when they talk about Bill Cosby, them saying that he was slipping them some sort of Mickey to get them involved in a romantic tryst? Come on, man. I know it's a white woman. I know we gotta, you know, do everything that we possibly can to placate white women and minimize their role as sexual predators and race soldiers. But I mean, romantic tryst, white journalism, racist, white supremacist journalism. Next, there was a listener this, or I don't know if the person is a listener or not, but I posted on my Facebook page, Stephon Clark. They've had the protests and what have you for, I guess, some time now. And during one of the protests over the last week in Sacramento, a white woman, suspected racist, got hit by a car. You heard it in the audio segment where they said the enforcement officer hit one of the protesters and kept driving. He hit this white woman, kept driving. They had a big article about that. I posted and I said that I hoped that she did not become like a Heather Hare, where they rally behind this, you know, suspected racist white woman. And, oh, my gosh, I can't believe she got hit in the street. So I post this on the Facebook page for the cows. A person writes on the Facebook page. Now, they have a photo of someone who would be identified as black, I think. But I mean, hey, this is, you know, online. Who knows? They write another black woman on the front line risking life and limb for a black male who hated her in life. I deleted the comment. Now, you know, hey, it could be a racist. That happens a lot. There's tons of that online where racists pose as black people. I'll only say if that's, you know, the authentic views of a non-white person, please find another page, another program to listen to post on. I have zero interest in any of that sort of anti-black bile. Particularly if you want to use the death of a black person who was shot and killed, you want to use that as a moment for whatever your political views are. And I mean, it's a long history of that. And I think that is just some of the most tacky, trifling conduct ever. Whatever position that you have, you can make that. You do not need to stand on the corpse. And I'm not even using a metaphor because that's, in my view, that's literally what these people are doing. Standing on the corpse of a black person to make whatever little political point that you have. And I've had to endure this repeatedly. We had a listener call in live on the air on a compensatory call in, no less, when Jonathan Farrell, black male, was shot and killed in North Carolina. Days after he was killed, we had a listener called in and said, well, I'm paraphrasing, but well, you know, he got what he deserved. He's probably running around with a white woman. Jonathan Farrell was not with a white woman. Even if he was, I don't know why that would be the time to dial in to give that sort of speech days after he's been shot and killed. To be completely transparent, as they say, this listener did dial in a week later to apologize and even admitted that they had not really looked at this case, that they were just speaking without being informed. Whoa. This happened again with Renisha McBride. A listener called in during the compensatory call-in, no less, called in live after she was shot and killed, Renisha McBride, to take this opportunity to say that the people in Michigan, were the black people specifically in Michigan, were cowards and allowed this to happen and no good nicks and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've seen and heard this many, many times. Anybody out there, if that is your, that's something that you engage in, waiting for when a black person dies, that's when you want to take the time to fuss at other black people, please do not do that on anything associated with the context of white supremacy. Last thing that I wanted to get in, I could just talk about my yoga class and racism forever. I think we could do tons of programs about that. For any of the folks who are tired of hearing about all of that, my apologies. I'm sure you all have tuned out. This happened on Wednesday, April 4th, away from the class. My favorite yoga instructor, non-white female, quote-unquote Asian, she happens to live two blocks from where my temporary residence while I'm hanging out in lieu of the flood. So we walk home from class, she to her residence, me to my residence, two blocks separating us. We walked home from class, I think, the last two times. So walking home from class Wednesday morning, it's, we'll say, 7:45 a.m. We do not talk about races. I think I've taken probably close to 50 of her classes this year, that many times that I've seen her. We've talked about all kinds of things, hydration, yoga, traveling. We both used to live in California. Never talked about racism. Don't even know how it came up. Somehow on our short, and this walk is very short. It's, you know, and it's 15 minutes if you stroll kind of slowly. At the pace that I normally walk, this is like a 10-minute walk, maybe less. We're walking. Somehow racism comes up, and she says, I grew up in Austin. I was immediately thinking, wow, have you been paying attention to the bombings? Didn't bring it up. She said, I grew up in Austin. There were no Asian people there. I grew up pretending to be Mexican because there were no Asian people there. Wow. I'm saying just wow, the abominations that the system of white supremacy creates. Anyway, so she continues talking, and she's just like, yeah, it was so confusing and so difficult growing up there and blah, blah, blah. And she's talking about somehow she goes from there, and she's talking about the term person of color and how she does not like that term. And I also think that that term is incorrect. I don't use it either, which I was surprised because I rarely hear people critique that term. Somehow we go from there to the police. And this is mostly her. Like I said, I didn't bring up this conversation. I'm not really driving the discussion. But she gets to the police and she says, you know, I think the Seattle police are great. I mean, in comparison to everywhere else that I've been and all the problems and things, like, I think the Seattle police are great. Like, my experience with them has been great. And I looked at her and I'm thinking, you know, obviously you're not a black person. Second, I'm thinking of, should I share a personal anecdote? The time the police came to harass me for brushing my teeth outside. The time the police harassed me for picking up $2 on the sidewalk. Just going through the different, you know, interactions that I've had. The time the police harassed me for wearing a scarf in January. Just going through my different, you know, interactions with the great Seattle Police Department. But I stop and say, whoa, we don't need a personal Gus T anecdote. I say, the Seattle Police Department is under consent decree. They have a federal monitor for abusing non-white people. And she says, I'm sorry. And I said, yeah, just like Ferguson and Newark in New Jersey and New Orleans in Louisiana and insert the other police department. But yeah, they're under consent decree, they have a federal monitor, like a federal judge looked at evidence and then decided that, oh, yeah, Seattle police have a tendency to abuse non-white people. I wasn't even thinking of, you know, all the different examples of people. Remember the black male who had a cane and a white woman police officer came and said, oh, he's got a weapon. We got to take him to jail. I wasn't even trying to go through and pick out all the different examples of police terrorism in Seattle specifically. But she said, after she stopped and she listened and she said, wow, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about that. Now, the irony about this abounded for so many reasons. One, because we live two blocks from the police department. In fact, I think we walked past the police department while having this conversation. just on so many levels. And even as all of this conversation is happening, I'm also thinking this person does have a fiance, unfortunately. Man, confusion is lethal. And she says, interestingly, she doesn't get angry. I don't, you know, yell. I just, you know, that's a statement of fact. I say it's in the paper all the time where they're talking about the consent decree and the police have been upset about, because this has been going on for years. This was way before Ferguson even happened. But yeah, the police have been fighting against this and saying that they don't like it and it's too many rules and blah, 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 and all that. Anyway, this is in the Seattle Times, like, daily basis. So anyway, so she says, wow, I don't, that's so interesting. She says, I know my experience is not yours because you're a black male. And I mean, obviously, they treat you way different. Duh. And she says, you know, I don't see the police very often, which I also found strange because, again, we just walked past the police department and we live like in the middle of Seattle, like the middle of downtown Seattle, like some of the main arteries, main streets in Seattle that the police are on all the time. I mean, we're just constantly walking the same street that we walked on Wednesday. Today, as I was walking to class, 9, and I counted them because I knew I was going to say this on the program, 9 bicycling officers passed me on my stroll to class. I was just stunned at how, you know, what are you watching? What are you paying attention? Is your suspected racist partner, is he, you know, that entertaining, that enthralling? But she said, more interestingly, when we got closer to her residence, 2 blocks from my residence, she said, you know, I go back and forth. Some days I'm like, man, F the police. They're so racist and they're messing us over. And then other days, just like, oh, I don't know. It's tough. That's a rough job. And they're not so bad here. Blah, blah, blah. I thought of Pam. We miss you, Pam. I've called. I hope she is doing well. I will follow up. She just, you know, had still been having some health problems and was trying to take care of herself. But we definitely miss, need, hope Pam will be back healthy and able to speak with us soon. But I thought of Pam immediately. You cannot lay down with white and then get up and think you're going to fight against or make sense with racism, white supremacy. But that was the first part of my morning, Wednesday, April 4th. I take multiple classes. So I took my 6:30 a.m. class. I go back for my 10 a.m. class. I'm walking down the same hill. I hear someone, hey, Gus, I look. It is the white woman who owns the yoga studio. Oh, what's good? Right on. She's on her electric bicycle. She's got her helmet. I told you I've been in like the most hipster possible parts of Seattle. Tons of this every single day. So she's on her electric bicycle with the helmet, the whole nine. And she says, I'm going to the 10 a.m. class. I said, oh, me too. I think we're on 12th. The yoga studios, I think on 8th. So we're maybe 4 blocks from class, 4 city blocks from class, maybe 5. She says, she's not on the bike. She's holding it. We're at the stoplight. She says, she asks, may I walk with you to class? I say, sure. We're walking down the hill. And she says, you know, we have that workshop that you wanted to attend tonight. They had a workshop entitled Deepening Series, Unpacking Whiteness. what I'm just reading the paragraphs, you all know what this series is about. What is whiteness? What is white privilege? How can folks who identify as white become more aware of internalized racism and white supremacy in ourselves and the world? And how can our spiritual practice support white folks to courageously follow this inquiry without collapsing in shame and guilt? This is a 6-week series that ran from February to April. Every Wednesday night, you had to pay $110 to attend. I wanted to attend, but I obviously was not going to pay a nickel to go. And she said they needed to have a council. I lost interest after that and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so 6 weeks later, the thing was ending on April 4th, later that day. So we're walking down the hill and she says, the meeting is going to end tonight. It's been really intense. My mom came and we've been just, you know, talking about white supremacy and our role in it as white people and sitting with that, doing body postures. And I said, body postures? And she said, yeah, you know, just it's stressful. You know, we were the instructor, you know, she showed us pictures of black people being lynched. And, you know, we just sat there, you know, it was nothing to say, just to look at this. And, you know, we would just sit and meditate, you know, just sit with being uncomfortable. And, you know, what's our relationship? How have we contributed to that? And, you know, then we would talk and different things that happened here. And I was like, wow, that's, she said, yeah, they showed videos. I said, oh, what are some of the videos that they showed? She said, well, I don't remember off top, but I have a list. I made a list. And if you want the list, I will share it. I said, let's have the list. I would love to check it out. So we get all the way, there. Class is about to start. And she says, yes, I would love to continue the dialogue. I know that you're a journalist and you talk about these issues. And I know that you don't want to hear white people talk about these issues in class, which was important because that is exactly almost verbatim what I told a different individual. In fact, the person that I identified previously as asterisk, this person I think could be white, but upon further review, it turned out they did have a white parent, a non-white parent. If you really, you know, forced me to make a decision, I'd have to say suspected racist perhaps could be white, but having seen this person a few times, I think they have enough melanin that a substantial number of whites probably would say, no, not going to be classified as white. Anyway, I had told that individual that I did not want to hear any whites come to class. This was in reference to the tubby racist who came to class and said that everybody had privilege. I was not interested in hearing a white person get up and talk to me about anything, about racism, do the postures. That's what I came for. I am not interested in hearing you get up, and particularly if we're not going to have a dialogue. I had said that. Probably a few, and I gave my definition of white supremacy with a different staff person. They went back and told the white person, which is what you should expect in any of these type of environments. No problem. I smiled. Cool in the gang. She emailed me, in fact. We're supposed to have a chat. She does have the list. When I get it, I will share the list, and I will also see if we can get the white person who did this workshop with the body postures and lynching photographs. I'm going to see if we can get them on the program. But that was my Wednesday morning, just two walks to and from yoga class where racism, and I did not bring racism up either time. Both times, the person that I was walking with voluntarily brought up racism. With that, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. No metaphors for the compensatory call-in. If we could speak directly, explicitly about what it is we would like to say, that would be great. I will prompt about that. If we could take 5 minutes to share whatever comments that we have, that also would be grand. Make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you have extra commentary, just wait for everyone to speak once, and then you can share again later in the broadcast. If you could use your mute button, that would be really appreciated. It just helps preserve the audio quality of the program. If you know you're in a noisy environment, just use your mute, say whatever you need to say, and then mute your line. That way people don't have to fight over unnecessary background noise. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943. #3#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Yes, I be heard.
Oh, greetings, our young caller in the Bay Area. Very good to hear from you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to discuss one of the audio clips relating to the Cornerstone shooting. My opinion on it is that, the shooting was kind of outrageous. I think it was one shot that killed him. And however, I feel like you shouldn't even be stealing in the first place. This is hard for you to buy just one bottle of beer or a six pack or whatever. You shouldn't even be in the store anyway. If you can't afford it, just leave. It wasn't really that big of a deal. Just one beer. However, it was also not a big deal just to shoot the guy over one beer. I just kind of feel like they were wrong from both perspectives, but the owner of the store was kind of more wrong just based off of his action, his response towards the conflict. But overall, yeah, the whole stealing thing, I didn't know it was about stealing until I heard he stole a bottle of beer and ran. My main point is that if it's hard for you to buy something just as simple as a bottle of beer, just you shouldn't even be in the store in the first place knowing that you don't have the money. If you need, you really don't even need a bottle of beer like that, honestly, because it really wasn't worth it. But I feel like some solutions that could have been done were maybe better surveillance or more security by the doors just to see what's happening and if the person could be stopped without unnecessary violence such as that shooting. And another video I wanted to discuss was based on a line of cops shooting at a black guy with a mental illness. My opinion on that is that the cops just shot him just right away, just no remorse at all, no sign to stop, think, maybe what's in his hand before we shoot him. I don't think they stopped to say freeze or the regular protocol. But as far as I know, they just shot him right away without any sort of background or anything. I'm not sure Saeed something. It's just I forgot the name.
Which segment are you talking about?
I'm talking about the segment where it was a black guy with a mental illness. He got shot at right away by a line of police.
Oh, the New York shoe. But give me a second to make sure I pronounce it correctly. If you want to continue your commentary, you can while I'm getting it for you.
Okay. I don't think they knew that he had a mental illness. However, they should always consider that. I feel like they consider it at other times if it's a non-black person or a white person doing the same thing. But as far as I know, it was just a metal pipe. He was just doing no harm except for not. I heard the video and heard he was aiming it at other people, acting like it was a gun. Apparently, he was in shooter's position. That kind of reminded me of Tamir Rice's incident where he was playing with a toy gun. But this is the older man, however, he has a mental illness. That just kind of reminded me of that, and I just kind of thought, I was like, wow, this happened before. But, I just feel like there should be better training in a police academy and better handling with guns overall, because apparently people don't know how to use them correctly in order to gain justice or whatnot. But overall, I just feel like both of those videos were sort sort of unjust from one perspective. But, yeah, this is my thoughts about it. Thank you for taking my call.
Young scholar in the Bay Area. His name, I think, is Saheed Vassal, I think is the correct pronunciation. S-A-H-E-E-D-V-A-S-S-E-L-L. Saheed Vassal. He was 34.
Can I have your...
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele, and I'm currently passing through Los Angeles. And I just want to say VGQ, you know, VGQ, you know, I'm aghast at how conditioned we are to accept the murder of black people. Regarding the murder of the young black child that was killed for allegedly stealing a beer, the news, I don't know if how many of us victims we caught this, but the news rarely ever accuses somebody of or lists somebody as a criminal without a trial. They usually will say the alleged thief or the alleged shooter. Like, for instance, Nicholas Cruz in the news is not referred to as the Parkland shooter. He's the alleged Parkland shooter. You know, I honestly, I'm really, really at a point where it's understood to me, it's abundantly clear to me that these people won't stop until they're forced to stop. They will make up lies and believe them as they're being made up. And they have conditioned us to accept that. I don't know. We have not seen any footage of this person stealing a beer. We have not seen any beer was recovered from the scene. So why don't we just say that this child was murdered, or he was shot in the back, allegedly, and why don't we just stop treating this like it's a justifiable incident? Same goes with the person that was killed in New York. You know, when suspected white supremacists come up to another racist suspect with a gun, regardless of how it's holstered, regardless of how it's shouldered, regardless of how it's being held, the first thing they do is start talking. And they start reasoning and explaining, and none of that was done. None of that was done in this case. And for us to look at that and say that's okay, for us to look at this, to see this footage, anything that they produce, that even anything that they say and produce that justifies or backs up their actions should be looked upon with suspicion by everybody, especially us victims. For us to get on the line after Gus explained how disturbing it was to have people justify the murders of our fellow victims, I'm just saying that none of these killings are justified. They're all war crimes, straight up. And I'm going to mute my line at this point. We're in danger. We're in a lot of danger.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. With the incident with the young black male who was shot over the beer, I thought it should not be minimized that they said the body was left outside for days. Just thought that should not be minimized in the report. The other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from at all, if you had commentary, line should be open. Folks spectating, just waiting.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to the host, peace to everybody listening tonight, and to the entire Black community everywhere. This is V from Central New York. Always glad to catch a live show two times. I'm loving this. This is good. Gus, I'm glad to hear that you are on the mend, especially, and your voice is definitely a lot stronger than it was about a year ago. So hopefully that means you are definitely not in any more pain, and life is progressing well. There are two particular topics that I want to touch on tonight. First, I want to again encourage everybody who is listening to please start to engage in event planning, learn how to develop educational programs, learn how to really become the change that you want. A lot of us have amazing ideas, absolutely great ideas, but we don't ever know how to put them into action. So researching how to create a lesson plan, how to teach a course, how to educate people, and how to organize events, all of these things are really items that we need to make ourselves familiar with so we can help our communities grow out of this white supremacist and racist situation which we find ourselves in. The two items, in addition to that I'd like to touch on first, I found it very striking that in the yoga class, the special class that they were doing about white supremacy, that they wore utilizing body positioning or body postures to deal with the discomfort that they were feeling in looking at those videos or those images, and specifically challenging whatever thought or narrative was running through their minds at that time. This is usually done to prepare a person who is going to go into an uncomfortable situation to kind of raise their tolerance for discomfort. And so they can hold a clear mind while confronting that discomfort, if that makes sense. So this should be a sign to Black people everywhere that these types of classes aren't necessarily built to help solve the issue of racism, but to help those who would have to confront Black people in their accusations and the conversation of victims of white supremacy racism, help them to deal with it more. It's not really built for us. So we too should be dealing with the potentialities of that. I suppose we'd have to get into yoga and stuff like that too, which of course Gus has suggested. And lastly, I happen to be a studier of Martin Luther King, and the idea of his redeem the soul of America comes from the original SCLC Constitution, if memory serves me correctly. And you can find a copy of the SCLC Constitution online. All you have to do is Google it. And he referenced this several times, particularly after 1965. There was a lot more referencing to it. And it was supposed to stand for the idea of redemption for America, which even towards the end of his life, he realized or started pondering if that was ever going to happen. Finally, Dr. King is one of the least understood people in this country, and a lot of the work that he did is still hidden from us. So there's supposed to be a resumption of the 14-volume set that Stanford is releasing and started releasing back in the 90s. Apparently, they're going to complete that set in the 2020s. So hopefully the image will be completed with the completion of that project. Gus, thank you very much for your work. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, sir. Reading is more important than watching television. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. Just a quick, I have a bunch of things I wanted to share, but just quick to the young scholar from the Bay Area. There is an article on theroot.com. I'm not necessarily someone who likes The Root or reads it a lot, but there is an article about the teenager. His name was Dorian Harris. It's called Tennessee Store Clerk Charged with Murder and Shooting of Black Teen for Allegedly Stealing Beer. And I do appreciate Kent Steele's commentary about that as well. Use definitely making sure we use the word allegedly. If you did want to get some more information, maybe that might help a little better understanding of that situation. The first thing I did, another thing I did want to share actually today, there was a kind of like a community festival or something like that, a community gathering, basically with in an area where a lot of Black people are or reside, and they had there were a bunch of different vendors, and they had free yoga classes. So I did go. It was a comedic yoga class, and for beginners, and it was really nice. And I liked how they used different terms, like it wasn't just like downward dog. They called it there was serpent, and I forgot some of the other terms, but there was pyramid instead of like mountain pose. And they had like the mummy pose instead of like the, I know Gus had spoken about how during that particular pose, he hugged himself. I'm not sure what, I guess white people call that pose, but they called it mummy pose. I liked it. And when I got done with it, I felt like really energized. It was really hard. So I feel like in the next couple of weeks, I will be getting into practicing more because it was actually the studio that I looked up during the Tuesday show about yoga. That's what actually led me to finding out they even had this type of festival, because there was no, you know, of course there's no real advertising for things that are maybe to help Black people. And it was really nice. The instructor was a Black person. I think she might have had a white parent, but she was definitely very nice. She started off the class saying, well, you know, if you can't do something, we could definitely modify it. Or you know, I can help you or what have you. It's not something that where you have to do exactly what she was doing. So there was that. Then the other thing that I wanted to share was just from the newspaper. It's the Sunday, April 1st, Las Vegas Review-Journal. The first thing is an article about the opioid epidemic. It says candidate downplays opioid epidemic, and it's just basically talking about a Nevada governor candidate, Chris, I don't know the last name. I don't know how to pronounce the last name. It's a white woman. And basically how she said there's an epidemic and it's not just opioids because with no disrespect, that's a white person's drug. And that's her quoting it. And she was like, well, you know, we have to deal with heroin and drugs and alcohol and gambling. That's all across the state. And then they also, one of the things that I did like, which I'm going to add to my ever increasing knowledge about this opioid epidemic. She was talking about how they needed more money to address it. And she said that we never have really restored the funding that was cut back in the 80s. And back in the 80s, that's when there was an epidemic, but with Black people. So it kind of makes sense that Black people were really affected and dying because they cut the funding when they needed it. But no surprise there. And then also from the same article, it made me think about something that Thomas from New York said, how he was saying, well, it's not just basically affecting white people, you know, it's affecting Black people as well. And this is exactly what it says in the article. It says basically talking about how the addiction was really white, affecting white people, but lately the trend has shifted. And it's saying that African Americans, there has been a steady rise of overdoses from 2010 to 2015, which is slower than white. And in 2016, there was a spike of 56% of African Americans' death rate. So it went from 6.6 per 100,000 to 10.3 per 100,000. And for whites, it was only it was higher than ours, of course. It was 13.9, but then it went to 17.5. And basically kind of just goes into it a little bit more from there. And then the last thing I'll share, because they did actually have like this big, they had a front page article about how Dr. King, he had visited the Las Vegas Convention Center back in 1964. It was like 5 months after JFK was assassinated, which is the largest article I've ever seen in the paper, because it had not just front page, but another full page and another half a page. Very last thing I'll try to hurry up and get out. They were talking about just also, there's another article kind of referencing Dr. King, and it says housing inequality lingers, and they have graphs, and it basically in the graphs for the FHA, so the Federal Housing Administration insured loans. Basically, they have it to where they have a graph where it says percentage of loan applications denied. For whites, of course, it's all they're the ones who get denied the least, but it's almost as if no white person or very, very few, maybe 1%, will get denied a loan for a FHA loan versus Black people, where it's about a little bit higher than 15%. But Asian and Latino, they're about neck and neck. I'm sorry, they're about the same at around like 10% denial rates. And I'll, if I have more, if there's more time, I'll maybe share some more. But thank you for allowing me to share. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. So glad to hear you were able to try out some yoga, Black instructor, comedic yoga class on top. Like, wow, that's great. Hopefully you'll be able to continue going and get stronger in your practice. That's self-care, Black mental health, hugely, hugely important. Other callers that we have, and sobriety would be best. I feel like that needs to be said for what the content that we've heard this evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Say it a few times. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Iman DC.
Yes, sir. And greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I was going to speak on two of the clips and the conversation that I had with Mr. Thomas in New York. The two clips was, one, the lady was, whoever was narrating the news clip, she would not concede that Martin Luther King was assassinated. She kept saying murdered. But when she mentioned JFK or whichever Kennedy, she said that he was assassinated. And I think that was an example of white supremacy. And the other was about the Black Panthers. They were talking about the elder Black Panthers felt or thought that it would be suicide for the younger Black Panthers to confront the police armed with arms. And I would just say there's a difference between sacrifice and suicide, and that's something that is learned in chess. You know, there's a difference between sacrifice and suicide. And so I would say, I don't know if that was a sacrifice or if that was a suicide mission. It would be more logical, in my opinion, to address white people, not the people who you see with a badge on, because all white people have been deputized as police officers. So it would have been more advantageous to address white people instead of one little segment of them. The conversation that I had with Mr. Thomas in New York concerning chemtrails, he was saying that he felt that the chemtrails here in America was causing the drought in Africa. And so I looked up some of the information, or I looked up some things, and there's articles that do confirm that the chemtrails that are being sprayed in the air, the aerosols here in America and in Europe, are causing Africa to have a drought, because they're making these places, Europe and America, artificially colder. And then so it changes weather patterns, changes wind patterns, and it makes it hotter in certain places. And then when it's hotter in certain places, the clouds aren't able to form in that area, or at least that looks like that's what the article is saying. And then the other conversation I had with him was about the Liberians being forced to remove or deported. And I ended up speaking with a Liberian here in the city that I'm in. And she was saying, yeah, it's a big concern. And she sent me some news clippings about, I think they had till the 31st of March to get out, or 31st of March before whatever protective status they were here in America under, that's now expired. But then there's been a year extension, and then they're supposed to be subject to deportation. What me and Mr. Thomas was thinking was, well, that would set the precedent. Well, let me not speak for Mr. Thomas, but it looks like that would set the precedent for if the Liberians, who are also African Americans, the Liberians are deported because their protective status is no longer being honored because the war is over, then couldn't the Moors be deported back to Morocco under the same guise? So that was something we were discussing. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mhandisi. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. There does seem to be a global pattern of large groups of black people being labeled and racially dislocated, being ejected from a particular geographic location. The situation with the Liberians here, also the situation with the Haitians. I think they had a large group of Haitians in the U.S. where their protected status, President Trump was saying they have to exit sometime soon. The situation in Israel, where they're saying that African immigrants there are being kicked out. And then the Haitians also down in the Caribbean out of, I forgot the other island, the Dominican Republic. There we go. But large groups of black people being, you know, forcibly removed from areas, happening, it seems, in more and more places on the planet, large numbers of racial dislocation. Other folks we've not heard from?
be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Good evening, everybody on the call. Good evening, Gus. This is caller in Wisconsin. Just a couple of things. One, thank you very much for the Tuesday broadcast on the Women of Color Healing Center. I really appreciated that broadcast, and it was very inspiring. I've looked into yoga classes here who are in Milwaukee that are taught by non-white women, and there is one studio that's run by a non-white Black woman. So I'm going to check that out. I noticed she has things like Nyanche yoga and yoga and mimosas. I don't know I'm looking for the correct word. I don't know how, I guess for lack of a better term, how much those classes will adhere to the actual purpose that yoga has, but it seems like she's trying to attract more non-white females, especially Black females, to the class, or maybe younger females. So I'll check her out. I also wanted to thank Ken Steele for his commentary tonight, because I do believe that is the case. It's either war crimes that white people are war criminals, and that they will not stop unless they are forced to stop. Finally, I do a lot of reading on slavery, especially for three reasons. One, I think that we owe it to our ancestors to know what they endured. I think, secondly, it gives you sort of a strength and resilience to know what your ancestors have endured, and finally, to know your enemy. I think that's really very important, because you can make a great deal of correlations between what is happening now and what happened then. And so I was at I was at my grandmother's nursing home. She's currently in hospice care, and I was at this nursing home, and I was. Most of the residents at this nursing home are white. And I noticed that most of the caretakers at this nursing home are non-white Black females. And I was just struck by this sort of mammy presence that I could feel, you know, in these old white people sort of looking towards these younger Black females as caretakers. And there was, I was sitting with my grandmother yesterday, and I overheard one of these older white males, you know, telling these Black females how much he hates the term African-American and you're just American. And, you know, he goes into this whole racist spiel, which I totally tuned out by, not on my counter racist grind right there. I probably should have listened, but I was just struck by that, like that these women are treated as mammies, that this concept still exists. And so I just always struck by these correlations to slavery everywhere I look, you know, and it seems to me like there's sort of this idea that either you fit into these good Black stereotypes that we have, or else you're labeled this impudent nigger and we have to get rid of you somehow, shooting you over an alleged theft of beer. So, that's all I have tonight, and thank you for letting me share. I'll mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. Caller in Wisconsin. So glad to hear people inspired to do yoga. We had a male caller who wrote, said he was going to check out a yoga studio. I hope people have a constructive experience. I took two classes today. I feel outstanding. It really can do a lot, especially if you can get non-white instructors, people that, you know, really are knowledgeable and care about the practice, are passionate and everything, like, can really be something where you feel just phenomenal. Folks we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Oh, greetings. Greetings, everyone. Yes, I'm. I observe in my observation of the documentary. You made pretty good points on what I observed. Also, it's just like I've said on the reading. is that, you know, ultimately white people have control over all of these film clips that they've done from the news or some other source, and they can just go into a room and just splice and record and re-record and put things together in with any fashion that they want to. I'm pretty sure also that there are tons of film of Dr. King that we haven't even seen since it was recorded, that they still have in their possession. I've even seen a photograph of Dr. King. Reportedly, it looks like he is showing a derogatory sign, you know, with the middle finger up, that sort of thing. I've actually seen that. Now, I mean, they can produce that and put anything as a caption underneath it. So that's basically what takes place with documentary as far as that's concerned. But I did see a lot of a film that I haven't saw before on him. The person that is called Little Bobby Hutton, although I don't like that terminology, Little Bobby Hutton, but Bobby Hutton. One thing that I've been around a lot of Black Panther members who was with the Black Panther Party when they were called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, and a lot of them really admitted the number of mistakes that they made, that they thought they made, as far as being emotional as opposed to thinking. And Bobby Hutton was an impressionable 16-year-old at the heat of the moment. At the moment of one has to understand the anger, the emotional atmosphere at that time when Dr. King was murdered. I was in the fifth grade, but even I can sense it at that particular point in time, and because I almost forgot about the history as it was with Bobby Hutton, that it, that did happen, you know, a few days afterwards. And there's actually the documentary where the person that he got the weapon from, his weapon from, stated that he, you know, it's an internal situation where he felt bad about the idea that he gave this young person this gun, and because he understood on what was going to happen to him, and it's like a regrettable situation, you know, as far as that concerned. And it's something to learn from also for younger people who are embarking upon having an understanding of the system of racism, what it is and how it works. Today was the another session, a beginning of another session of this Mr. Clark's mentoring program, which I participated in. Basically, it was the initial day, so it wasn't a whole lot of direct attention with the younger males, except for kind of like introducing them to the program and the do's and the don'ts as far as rules are concerned, and what basically is going to be taking place, and that sort of thing. And he did show them a film, I believe it was Black Panther, the modern day version, that was it as far as the program was concerned. But that's basically is the latest thing that I'm involved in. I don't necessarily identify myself as a mentor. You have to be a perfect person to be a mentor, and there's no such person, in my opinion. But every now and then he would want me to address them. And I'm thinking along the lines of, instead of talking directly about racism, white supremacy, is to talk about justice, such as codified understanding things like understanding on how to solve problems, what a problem is and how to solve problems. I think probably the most constructive things that you can share with another person, let alone talking about how old they are or, you know, young they are. And that's what I'm going to try to do, you know, in my participation in the program. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks, we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wait, go ahead, Amy. Okay. Did I hear Amy?
Yes, it's me. I'm greeting everyone. Really quickly, just I had a clip from class that I wanted to play, but the sound quality is very poor on my recording device, like this particular recording, so I don't think it will translate well. So I will share just pretty much the information that I learned in class that I think is helpful. We were talking about neurons in cell bio, and there are a lot of studies, but there's you know, there's all these images, and plus it's a white woman, and I know people will, you know, really resonate with this white woman more than me, even though I'm just repeating what she said, so listen, that exercise actually can create more neurons. It actually creates neurogenesis, and so different forms of exercise can stimulate and create new neurons in different parts of the brain. Cardio actually will help the brain not age, because the neurons actually, like the cells in your body, turn over or replicate themselves quite often, like a lot in your body. The neurons, on the other hand, don't quite do that as much once you reach 25. Like, you pretty much, what you got at 25 is pretty much what you have. And so, but exercising actually will jumpstart the neurons out of their resting phase, or what's called a resting phase, into the cell cycle phase to help them actually divide and create more neurons, which is really, really, it just has so many implications to be able to make more neurons. So many, like, you know, not developing degenerative diseases as we age, or anything like dementia. Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are really more from like protein folding, but still even being able to keep those cognitive functioning like super well. There's also evidence, like the food, and I'm not saying anything that no one doesn't know, but just to pinpoint some particular things that I learned that I think would be helpful, that not all diets work for all people. And by diet, I mean like just food intake, like what you eat. So you do want to pay attention, you know, to what's really good for you. But all of the darker fruits, like the blueberries, grapes, raisins, which are dried out grapes, figs, prunes, which are dried out plums, spinach, and even tuna, like fish, is actually supposed to be really good for the brain too. Another one, there was a study that was conducted in Baltimore that took older people from nursing homes and bus them into what they call inner city schools, and had those elder folks teach the younger folks how to read. The end of the study pretty much just showed that it helped everybody. Of course, it helped the young people learn to develop literacy, and it also helped the older people degress from their, you know, neurological degenerative states that they were in, like early dementia, Alzheimer's, and things like that. So so that whole part is pretty much saying that, like, because we're social, that actually socially interacting keeps our brains functioning at a high level, and can actually reverse just neurodegenerative diseases, is pretty much what I'm saying. And the last part of this lecture that I wanted to share is that the brain doesn't fully develop till 25, which I think is very important for people who want to smoke weed. Like, you just don't do it when you're younger. I mean, I'm not condoning it anyway. Sobriety would be best. I guess I'll say that too. But I know, you know, there's all this stuff about smoking weed and whatnot. Just your brain's not developed until like your mid-20s. So a white person said it before, that it's really not good when you're younger to smoke it, even though like there might not be bad things happening to you when you're older. When you're younger, it's just messing up your brain. And because since the brain's not done forming, you're going to develop different neural pathways and also like damage certain receptors. So you have a different relationship with your pleasure centers pretty much. Anyway, the brain is not like at its actually top functioning age for men until their 50s and women until their 60s, which I just think is fascinating. You know, Mr. Fuller, he always says, when you say, how you doing? I'm still learning. And I mean, there's signs to show it. So I'm in love. Anxiety decreases as we age, because I guess the older you get, the more perspective you have. And then the older we get, I mean, for us non-white victims of racism and white supremacy, I don't think we can ever be happy, but it's something to, you know, keep in mind, especially if you're younger, for us young folks dealing with depression or anxiety, suicidal thoughts and stuff like that. Like, not to say that that's normal, it's not normal, but it kind of is normal the younger that you are, because your brain is just overactive and really hasn't developed any type of, you know, you're still trying to figure things out. That's why the code can be helpful. So anyway, just kind of, I don't want to say hang in there, but, you know, if you're younger, just know that your brain can lie to you. And so that there's hope. The older that you get, the more experience that you have, the more codified you become, the less confused you become, the more clarity that you have to be able to be more calm and find your place in the world, and figure out how you will participate in establishing justice. The other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, every little thing that you do, it helps. Every single thing that you do affects you at a cellular level. I think it's just absolutely fascinating. So I know how, like, just anything, I'm going to say one thing that I thought about, but I'm just encouraging you to, whatever little thing you have around you, to figure out how to make it work for you. So I was going through this bag, which I'll talk about in a second, because I had meant to go through it. I was looking for something, and I happened to stumble upon like a stress ball. And so, of course, that got me wondering, well, like, does this thing even really work? So I did some basic preliminary research to see if it works, what's its mechanism of working. So it actually, I mean, there's some evidence to suggest that it doesn't work, but there's some evidence to suggest that it does. And if it does, the mechanism would be, you know, like if you're feeling stressed and you squeeze it, number one, it takes your mind off of the thing that you're stressed about, but also it transfers the energy like that you would probably be using to clench your jaw or tighten your shoulders into your hand. And so that the energy goes somewhere. Everything is energy. Dr. Welsing used to, well, yes, would say that often in some of the things that I've heard her, lectures I've heard her give on YouTube and whatnot. But that everything is energy. So if you're able to transfer that energy to an item, not like another person or to another part of your body, that could be helpful. So it's a stress ball. I'm not saying run out and buy stress balls. I'm saying, you know, like, let's use our creativity to figure out how to manage our stress, our anxiety, and figure out so we can stay level-headed and so we can solve our problem. The other thing that I completely kind of forgot that I had, but I think it's helpful, might be helpful to some people out there. I don't like a lot of clutter, so I try to get rid of things as often as I can. But at one point I began being creative with some of the things that I had. I was like, well, you know, this is when I was far more confused and I used to really watch The Walking Dead. And it's a joke, but it's not a joke. But I used to be like, well, if there was a zombie apocalypse, like, what would I do? You know what I'm saying? Like, where would my bag be? So I started a survival bag. Don't judge. And everyone should have one, but theirs are probably way more legit than mine. But I had a book bag. And so little things that I had that I probably would have gotten rid of, I kept. And so, you know, it's not together. Like, I went out and bought all these new things that have like a warming blanket and like, you know, bleach tablets for water and stuff. But flashlights, batteries, you know, things that I get for free at like fests and stuff like that, you know, it's all in their ropes. Like, you never know what could be helpful. So the point is, you know, it's sitting and being like, well, man, things are really, really bad and can get worse at any moment, is will create a different physiological, chemical environment inside of your body. If you have a different perspective, like, okay, I know things can get worse at any moment, but perhaps I can see a little bit further. It doesn't hurt to do those things. Even if you never use your bag, by having done that, you feel a little bit more secure. By having taken a class, you feel a little bit better. And I think if that doesn't dismantle it, it at least keeps you here long enough to, you know, come up with a solution. So I have other things to share. I hope everyone is well. I've been very stressed, but I hope you all are well and just, you know, we can do it. We got this. Thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that, Emmy. Sounds like she has a walking bag, a walking dead bag, not a get out bag. Ivy, thank you for yielding the floor. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. It was good to hear from the young scholar in the Bay Area. I was actually thinking about him yesterday because Kwame was on the line when we were going through the book study session of The Hate U Give, and I believe the two of them are close in age. I actually did this time listen to all the clips, so I took all the hits from the, or all the, I'll put it this way, all the, as you said, racist, white supremacist journalism. And I'm getting more and more interested in that, and I'm just going to, you know, just gradually increase my intake in that because I know it's important to stay aware of how racist, white supremacists are using words. I want to say that to the software developer in Wisconsin, I believe you said a family member of yours is in hospice. If I heard that correctly, my condolences to you, and I'll pray for you and your family. And, man, I really appreciated all the commentary tonight. I found it very, excuse me, informative. And just like the software developer said, you know, as far as what Ken Steele was saying, I really appreciated his commentary, just especially on the beer part. Like he said, we don't know for sure that this person, you know, stole a beer and all those things. I thought it was tacky and racist when one of the people on the clips, one of the racists, said that that one of the people who was murdered by, I believe, cops, that something to the effect of something about they didn't know about his mental illness or something, and that if he had, I believe he, they said if he hadn't been mentally ill or something like that, he wouldn't have been in a situation where, you know, he could be murdered, ultimately, is what the person said. And I'm thinking, what do you mean in a situation like that? There, what's wrong with a situation where this person has a cell phone and you murder them? Like, that's just crazy. And I just wanted to ask Gus, do you know, is there an update on you going home?
Nope.
Oh, well, that's really unfortunate. And I'll mute my line for now. Thanks, everybody. And thanks, Gus.
Appreciate that. Hanging out. A date to be determined. Other folks that we have not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Oh, greetings, Princess. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Good evening. I was just calling in real quick. Would it be okay if I share a bit of workplace racism?
Oh,
I had an incident that happened at work on Thursday and really couldn't, I wasn't in position to even be able to call because the situation is ongoing. But
oh, let's hear it.
Okay. Well, I had a meeting with an employee that I had been having issues with. She was a new hire, and basically, this is a non-white, non-black Latina from New York, and pretty much from the very beginning, I was a little bit suspect of her, not necessarily because my prejudices of most people from New York, but just her overall demeanor and just really as we say, hood, ghetto. And she basically last week, there was a situation with another non-white, non-black female from the Dominican Republic. And basically the girl jokingly from Latina to Latina was basically commenting on the fact that most Puerto Ricans are do good and bad things with cars. You know, you got to be careful out here in Marion Oaks because a lot of Puerto Ricans like to break and steal into people's cars. Now, she took it upon herself to go to the manager to try and basically state her case as to that this person is racist. She doesn't know where I'm from or my people. And, you know, Puerto Rico is still, you know, going through, and you said this out in the open where people could hear and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, you need to be mindful of things that you say because you don't know what people are going through. So I was in the break room, and like I said, one of the things that I've been dealing with is a lot of Latino people feeling that it's the right to be able to use the N-word in the presence of Black people. Whether it's indirectly or directly, especially on the job, and especially around Black people where no one is even talking like that. So it's an ongoing thing that I've been dealing with for the past month and a half. And so basically I was in the break room, she's going on talking to another Latino from Puerto Rico. And she was like, yeah, you know, she shouldn't have said that. And, you know, my people are still struggling back in Puerto Rico and blah, blah, blah. And she's racist and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, that's interesting. I'm still trying to figure out why everybody feels comfortable around here to use the N-word for Black people when it's been clearly expressed that we don't care to hear that while we're on the clock at work. And she immediately was like, oh, no, that's different because I know you and, you know, that's not an issue, blah, blah, blah. So fast forward to Thursday or Wednesday, rather, you know, she had this attitude with me because she had assumed that I had made a big deal about her switching her schedule. Although nobody didn't communicate with me, any other members of management over that last weekend. And so I had just marked it off, just showing that, you know, she was no call, no show. And the story, I wasn't, you know, didn't make a big deal out of it because I didn't even report it to the manager. So she apparently, I had communicated to my other manager over the weekend, some things that had happened with another employee that we had to let go. And so he took my conversation and divulged what him and I, as members of management, was talking to. And in reference to, you know, her not being at work and this, that, and the other. Instead of him, you know, keep that among ourselves, or better yet, just simply explaining to her, oh, she didn't know, yada, yada. She just blew the whole situation out of proportion. So next day, we had to have she wanted to have a meeting because I basically called her out on her work that she didn't do from the night before. And I had noted it, took pictures, and forwarded the documentation to my store manager. So when I came in that afternoon, he had it ready to go. And so basically, it was all four of us in the office. She went into this diatribe, Decepticon, mind game, and, you know, just lying about various things that took place throughout the my shift that evening. And so I finally, you know, she started yelling and raising her voice like we're out in the street. And so I finally had to check. I was like, yo, I'm not from the street. You don't have to, I'm right here. Use your inside voice. And she's like basically saying that in itself, me saying that was racist, and she's going to contact corporate and this, that, and the other. And then that's when my store manager had to interject and was like, oh, you're taking this, like, it was just out of control. So finally, I just said, well, if that's the case, then why is it that you feel comfortable in dropping the N-word every 5 minutes around the office on the floor? And, you know, you're out amongst other employees and customers. Like, what is that? And so that's when she started backpedaling and doing all this lying. And after the meeting wrapped up, she asked to leave during the middle of the shift because she was supposed to close. And so, you know, they allowed her to leave. So later on in the meeting, basically, as we were getting ready to leave, and we get close, I get into my car. And I'm speaking to my other coworkers. We're all leaving out at the same time. And turn on my car, put it in reverse. Car doesn't move. So I'm like, you know, what's going on? And this, that, and other. So I'm, you know, gunning the accelerator, and car is just not moving. It's not going in reverse. So I'm like, well, I just got my timing belt, all this stuff fixed. Just came from the dealership, getting oil change, and just trying to put things through my head. So my coworker, she comes over, and she's like, you know, what's going on? And I told her to get in the car just to make sure that I'm not going crazy. I thought my brakes were on. They weren't, but she was like, you know, I don't know what's going on. So finally, after the car and park, we're looking at it, flat tire. So I was like, okay. That looks highly suspicious because, I mean, it's literally on the rim. Like, it's completely deflated. I'm just like, I just came from the dealership, had a 50-point inspection, you know, along with my oil change. But, you know, I'm just trying to run things through my head and, you know, I'm already suspecting this chick has done something to my car. So my coworker had called her husband, was explaining the situation, and, you know, I just told her to leave. She was like, no, I'm not leaving here. You know, my husband's going to come and change the tire. So he was on his way. So we're already talking and suspecting, but, you know, I couldn't see anything that would, you know, explain, you know, how does this tire get like this? Like, I've had flats before. But, so she's walking around the car. She gets to the other side of the car, and she's screaming, you know, speaking in Spanish. So she's calling me over. Both front tires have been completely slashed. And we get confirmation once her husband gets there. Because he doesn't speak much English, but he's explaining to me. He's showing me where the puncture wounds are, excuse me, not wounds, but the puncture marks are, where somebody either had taken a knife or a blade or a pocket blade or something. Wrap this up, guys. Basically, I just got home because I didn't have a car. I was stuck in Ocala. Had to stay over my friend's house because just had to get things documented for documenting purposes. And as of right now, the person, yesterday I was gonna call out to work because I was just trying to keep tight lip because at that point I didn't trust anybody and I was highly pissed And so when I came into work early to try and speak with the store manager to let him know what happened, I had called him and left a message. He never returned it. Come to find out, he was in a meeting. So he found out midday and just was floored. And so basically, I pretty much gave him the ultimatum. Either I get transferred or she has to go, because when I came in around 12:45 yesterday, she, of course, reported to work. And when I walked in and she saw me, she immediately ran to the other manager. And then all of a sudden, inexplicably, oh, she had to go home. And what people was telling me was all of a sudden, she had made a comment saying that she had to get a ride from a neighbor, when in fact, she's always had a ride either from her girlfriend or her mother. So now she's getting a ride from an alleged neighbor. So luckily, I parked where we do have video footage. I hadn't had time today to look at it because we was just busy. And, you know, I was talking to my dad earlier because he, you know, was just, he used to be a detective. And he was just giving me some pointers about just me, just being conscious and mindful of my surroundings and stuff like that. But as of right now, more likely tomorrow, I probably will be dealing with corporate police department, because I did file a report. They did come out and they too confirmed what my friend's husband was saying. They took pictures, and so like I said, it's just an ongoing situation. But
well, that is quite a bit. Workplace racism is Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Floored is a metaphor. I am so sorry that you had to deal with all of that this week at all, really. That is horrendous. I mean, really, for things to get that bad on the job, like, wow, that is... safety would be priority one in terms of where you park. I don't know if they have designated parking at the facility where you work for employees, but I would definitely make sure that I am someplace visible, well-lit, as close as possible to the facility. I would definitely be trying to get the video camera ASAP. Hopefully it's on video, whatever happens, so that charges can be pressed to the fullest extent of the law. I don't know how they're going to respond in terms of your ultimatum, firing her or moving her or what have you. If it's on video, I mean, hey, that might be an easy one. If you got it on video that this was an employee who did this, to have her charged, terminated, and, you know, we can move forward. Yeah, anything of that nature, I think that's just staying in the question lane about the use. And I guess the only thing I would add with regards to them saying nigger on the job or whatever the derivative of it is, I would not use language that we don't care to hear this. This is not professional. I don't think there's too many companies are going to have that. Oh, yeah, this is a part of our corporate strategy, how we're going to be a Fortune 500 company. We call each other nigger all day long. Is this the way we're supposed to talk to customers when they come in? Anything you all need at the pharmacies today, niggers? That's the way we're supposed to talk, you know, when people come in to the facility? Like, no, this is not because we don't care to hear it. This is unprofessional, period, unless I've been misinformed. That's the way I would put it. But other than that, great job asking questions, staying calm. We talk about that all the time on Thursday, staying calm. Let everybody else get rowdy. I'm staying calm. I'm using my indoor voice. If you are able Thursday to give us the update, that would be great. But safety would be number one. I'm so glad you called the police. Safety with where you park your vehicle. And I would even make sure I wouldn't even, you know, go out by yourself if you're working shifts in the evening or what have you. If that's being escorted or whatever it is, safety would be priority one in this situation, in my view. Do we have anybody that we missed completely? Anybody who had a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to the host, the listeners, and callers. I have like a few things I wanted to comment on, not very much. I was looking on Amazon to purchase some art products, and I came across these markers, and they're called the skin tone markers. I'm not sure what brand they are, but just to show that racism is a part of everything, or racism is everything. I think I've heard that quote. In this particular product, they had two white images of white people, I guess. And it's called like hair and skin tone markers. And like some of the names of the markers, like one of them is baby skin white, milky white, okay, cream. And I think one is called flesh. And these look like colors that would be used to bring about an image of a person on a sheet of paper. And it seemed like they had like darker colors, like a darker brown. And I think most people would use that to color the hair of a white person. So I thought that was fascinating. And there was another article that I read about a black parent, and I think it's Rayleigh, North Carolina. She said that her 8-year-old child was given an assignment about white privilege. I didn't necessarily get to see the whole video, but she was in a disagreement about the child learning about racism. She was like, "Hey, you know, what does my child have to do with learn about racism and white supremacy?" She's only 8 years old, so I'm not sure what was the update on it. And the last thing was, I heard that it was, I guess you can consider this a metaphor where they had on the audio segment about the victim who had the mental illness, who was, I think, gunned down by law enforcement. I think that may have been a black person that said even Ray Charles could see that man was crazy. Did you hear that, Gus?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, like I thought about like when you were listening to the metaphors and the analogies and the similes, like that was a major one. And then the word crazy was used too. So yeah, I had to jot that one down. So that's the only thing I had to share right now. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
For sure. If people recall, we talked about that metaphor specifically. When people say, you know, even Ray Charles, you know, could have seen that he didn't, you know, have a gun, or, you know, however they invoke Ray Charles or Stevie Wonder. We talked about that, it seems peculiar in a racist way that the only blind people that get referenced for these, you know, comments that people make, whatever the context is, Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, every time. Only ones that get mentioned. Yeah, we talked about that on the program before, and I do not invoke those sayings anymore, on the air, off the air. Any other folks have commentary that had a hand up that we missed completely?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Roz. Good to hear from you, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. It's been so hectic for a while, so I haven't been able to call in as much as I want, so I will be making a strong attempt to do so. And thanks again. I love the show. Great program this evening. I had a couple of things I wanted to discuss briefly. I'll try and be as quick as I can. First, I forget who it was. It might have been Ken Steele who brought the use of the term alleged. It might have been actually a black female, if I remember correctly. I'm a little off. But it reminded me of a story I heard of Minister Malcolm X when he had the Organization of African American Unity. And the periodical that they were going to release at a particular time before he passed away, in which a young black male was killed by, I believe it was a police officer, if I remember correctly. And they were doing a write-up on what happened. And the person who was writing it up actually used the term murderer. And Minister Malcolm stopped him. He said, there's legal ramifications to using that term.
He has not been, hasn't gone to trial yet, so we cannot use that term. We have to use the term allegedly. And he broke down why. He said, you know, you can't call somebody in a legal sense, use the legal term, unless the person has been duly convicted of a crime. And that was his reasoning at the time. And the person who the writer actually spoke about that and how astute Minister Malcolm was, something that seemed so innocuous was so powerful in his understanding of the use of language. And I just wanted to, it made me think of that. Also, too, I've been a practitioner of Tibetan spirituality for like 24 years now. And yoga is a part of my practice. There's a great Black author by the name of Muwatta Ashby, Dr. Muwatta Ashby. And he has a series of books on the African Nile Valley origins of yoga. And details on how to put those things into practice. It's been a part of my practice. I went through initiation, but I also use and read his text as well, because he had a whole spiritual system based on Egyptian yoga. The title is actually Egyptian Yoga Volume 1, 2. I believe there's a third volume as well, and there's a slew of books, like 30-something books he's written on Kemetic spirituality. So if anyone is interested in learning more about that, and I would definitely suggest his work. He's been writing for decades on the subject, and he's considered one of the top in that particular field of spiritual practice. So I do want to just put that out there for anyone who might have been interested in that. And lastly, we always talk about the use of words, and the word mentor is something that's used quite regularly by us and all people, just because it's the term that we've been given by white people. And it has pedophilic, homosexual connotations. And I just wanted to read something brief in regards to that. It's an article called Jenna versus Mentor, the story of Mentor and Telemachus. It says, we must understand that Greek mythology is just that, a myth. These made-up stories are of people that never existed. Why did Whitey create them? Probably to validate their existence, but we must understand many customs we've adopted, have been done so through ignorance of this quote-unquote little case in point, the use of the word mentor we so lovingly use for our African scholars that have influenced us. We forget the power we give to something when you call on its name. Couple this with ignorance of the origin of these words, we actually are disrespecting something we intend to respect. The word mentor is defined as an advisor, guide, guru, counselor, consultant, confidant. Look at the last word in the definition, confidant. Now, when we look that definition up, it says a person with whom one shares a secret or private matter, trusting them not to repeat it to others, unquote. Now, let's take a look at the history of the word mentor again. In Greek mythology, mentor was the son of Alcimus, and in his old age, a friend of Odysseus, a.k.a. Ulysses. When Odysseus left for the Trojan War, he placed Mentor in charge of his son, Telemachus, and of his palace. Mentor, however, apparently had other plans that went beyond the mere development of Telemachus's cognitive skills. Mentor, like many a societal norm of Greece, was a homosexual who preyed on young boys to be used in their queer escapades. Mentor carefully cultivated a sexual relationship with Telemachus. Many are not aware that Greece was a society where homosexuality was the norm. Men took great pride in feeling the greatest love could only be experienced between two men, and women were only used for procreative purposes. The excuses given for this imbalanced yet societal acceptance of sexual misconduct was often explained as a man literally injecting male principles into the child through his buttocks. And we can see figuratively the sick pleasure a predator has in quote-unquote having his way with a child, never thinking of the natural displeasure and residual damage done to said child. This is the source of the modern use of the word mentor, a trusted friend, counselor, or teacher, usually a more experienced person. Some professions have quote-unquote mentoring programs in which newcomers are paired with more experienced people in order to obtain examples and advice. Schools have also have mentoring programs for new students who are having difficulties. Even apprentices often refer to superiors and even elders as their mentor. This word must be analyzed, historically processed, and frankly removed from the African vocabulary. This is key, for when we use this word, we are unknowingly honoring and condoning the acts of a predator, something that has been widely accepted even in the perceived quote-unquote holiness of the Roman Catholic Church. The history of heads who created the English language have a completely different value system than us.
That's why it's important that we get in the practice of using the right terminology. The author of African Psychology, Dr. Wade Nobles, introduced a more suitable word when referring to those who have been an influence. The word is Jenna, spelled J-E-G, silent G-N-A. Jenak is the plural form. Are those special people who have, one, been tested in struggle or battle, two, someone who demonstrates fearlessness, three, one who has the courage to protect their people, culture, and way of life, four, shown diligence and dedication to our people, five, provide an exceptionally high quality of work, and six, dedicated themselves to the protection, defense, and nurturance and development of our young by advancing our people, place, and culture. Jenna, yes, that's more appropriate. So I just wanted to just drop that little gem on the term mentor. I stopped using it a long time ago. I know that it's something that we're comfortable with and that we hear on a regular basis in the system, but I just thought that I would just throw that out there and hopefully, you know, we'll start to use more appropriate terms than that. Thank you, and I'll mute myself.
Appreciate that, Roz. I know Dr. Mwalimu Baruti discussed that on a previous visit on the program, his similar thoughts on that term. Is it anybody that we missed completely? Anybody who has a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Grant, make sure we didn't miss anyone. Emmy, you have 45 seconds. Anything really important you need to make sure you get in before we wrap things up?
Thank you very much for checking in with me, but I'll save it for Thursday. So we'll speak then.
Workplace Thank racism, you. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Already had a dose right there. Tyrus, I mean, wow, that is so, just so many things. I mean, I was thinking back like years ago when people, horses were what people used for transportation. If you, you know, messed around with somebody's horse or stole their horse, I mean, they would kill horse thieves. I mean, because you could have someone stranded somewhere. That could be a life and death situation. You know, slashing somebody's tire. If you know, thankfully you had someone there. Talking about Princess's situation, thankfully someone was there to help her out so that she could, you know, get that taken care of and get the police called and all of that. But I mean, wow, that's why I say workplace racism is so important to discuss, because I mean, it gets serious, like frequently, all the time, like, you know, terminations and all that stuff is serious too. But then this sort of thing as well, like it's really, really important just to understand the danger, the hazards that we frequently have to deal with in the work environment. Just keeping that in mind and trying to have some strategies to help manage all of that. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks to all of the folks who dialed in to participate. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Thanks to all the folks who listened live or to the archive. If you have questions, gripes, complaints, Mr. Fox, who's done just phenomenal work investing in the program, uploading content to YouTube, which has helped lots of people access the archives. I'm still trying to get my act together to write the report on the Voltron effect, what that is. That's a metaphor too, to explain what that metaphor is and how whites work together. They can united, independent. They can function independently as racists. Then they can do a phenomenal job functioning collectively to terrorize non-white people, but to get to work writing that up so that he can do video work on that as well. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. We will be back towards the middle of the week. Check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page, for updates. If you have questions, as I said, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. For sure, on this broadcast, with what was discussed this evening, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it's springtime, weekend, people are, you know, looking at what they're going to do for the summer and school being out and all that stuff. Grand. Have fun. I would like to have some fun this summer too. However, we are still in a system of white supremacy. Racists love to take advantage when we are not thinking correctly and thinking, oh, we're having a good time and don't have to worry about racism too much. And then bad things happen, to put it mildly.
stay codified at all times. I know Dr. Welsing and many folks that we revere would certainly encourage us to take care of our brain computers. From a financial perspective, let's not give any of our nickels to racists for their poisons, narcotics, which are just going to further erode our mental, physical, spiritual strength to solve the problem. If you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, you certainly want to be sober and buckled up, driver or passenger. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.